Tonight on The Download, the director of the new documentary, A City at War, Chicago, John Davies, Midwest poet Marcus Wicker, and winter plant care with the Chicago Botanic Gardens. Now, here's your host, a man whose hydrangea plant is about to get kicked to the curb, Justin Kaufman.
You're here, bro. You're here talking about how great his hydrangea is. He's like, well, you know, when the people come over to work it or out for me, when my gardening people come by. The Download, we don't have people. I do this by hand. This is my job. I'm the one who mixes the Tabasco sauce with whatever I was supposed to mix it with, or goes to the Home Depot and gets the deer urine to keep the rabbits away. I don't have people for that. Row. Such 1%. 1% gardener. I have to say, though, as I'm excited, the Chicago Botanic Garden's back in the house tonight. As if you're a longtime listener to Download, you know how much I get frustrated with my lack of a green thumb. I've done wonders with my yard. And it's not really a yard. Again, it's more like a foyer. It's about the size of a foyer. But I've put in new bushes, like in the front, flowers on the side. I've done a really nice job. But this year, I was very excited because I thought about it. I'd worked out I put some marigolds in for the rabbits. You know, I had the perennials. Everything was all set. I was ready to go. The annuals, the perennials, the minimums, all this stuff. And then my hydrangeas just didn't come up. Like, they sprouted, like, green leaves and stuff. But the actual bulbs were just not there. And so I got frustrated because I'm like, what's up? Is this the soil? What's going on? What's going on? Is there rust in the soil? I don't know what's happening. And then I read online that they said, and I asked around, they said sometimes they just don't come up. Like, it's every other year with a hydrangea. Maybe you have an every other year hydrangea. That's so bogus. So I can't wait to have Chicago Botanic Gardens on. It's going to be an interrogation. No, we'll talk about not just my plants, but of course how to treat your yards. We'll take calls too, 312-981-7200. It's a Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. John Davies, my guest at the big table, longtime legendary TV producer, going to bring his new work, A City at War, Chicago, to TTW, Channel 11, on Thursday night. We'll talk to him about Chicago and what he learned about our role in World War II. That's coming up. Marcus Wicker's here tonight, great poet. Tremendous poet. He's got a new collection called Silencer. We'll talk about his life. He writes from a point of being growing up black in the Midwest. He grew up in Michigan, and how that perception changed his life, but also how he looks at issues like gun violence or police brutality, and how it colors his work. And so we'll talk with Marcus Wicker, who's a brilliant poet. He's got great accolades for this new collection. So he'll be in the show 9 o'clock hour with Chicago Botanic Gardens as well. And we'll play the worst tonight. Scott Goldstein's in Curb Your Enthusiasm, Scott Goldstein. The other day I was watching Curb and he's in the background. You know, I don't know how he scored that, but Scott Goldstein, longtime improviser, comedian here in town, and a guy who pops up on my screen on HBO. I'm like, there's Goldstein. He'll be in playing the worst tonight. And also the Download in Chicago Business. Catalin Rodriguez Ogren from Pow Gym. We'll talk about the business of fitness. Not just fitness, Pete. High-intensity fitness. And what the challenges to running your own boutique gym here in the city of Chicago is. She'll be my guest on the Download on Chicago Business. All that coming up tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. Lots of great hydrangea advice coming through, including Gemini. She's got a great point. She said, I used to have a problem with it, but when I asked the people at the Botanic Garden, they said it needs constant fertilizer. I did it, and it worked. It bloomed every year. And you're like, all right. But then 815 says, it's all about the sunlight. Got to have the sunlight. Otherwise, they won't bloom. All right, you know, I don't know what to say.
Sounds like a scam. Yeah, total business is a scam.
Yeah. Let's carry out.
Hey,
Here today at Top Stories, the president was pressed about gun laws and tightening up background checks while in South Korea. His response, laws aren't the answer. Just look at, I don't know, Chicago. Chicago is a disaster, a total disaster. So can you declare it a disaster so we get more federal funds available to fight gangs on the South and West sides? Sure. Oh, no, I get it. You're using that Trump speak. It's not actually a disaster. It's just as it's not the likes in which we've never seen before. It's another one he loves. Or hashtag so sad. It's not really that sad. It's just the way the president talks to fill space. Got it. I'm figuring it out. Took me a while, but I'm figuring it out. But the truth of the matter here is that Chicago is a city with millions of people, and reporters and the public ask our elected leaders what we should do about the rash of mass shootings. He goes out of his way to disparage an American city. Again. Yes, we get it. Chicago has a serious violence, gang, and gun problem. The president knows that. But this tragedy was in Texas. And as we Chicagoans feel for and keep those parishioners in our thoughts and prayers, our president decides to do exactly what his staff blames the media for doing, playing politics. Regardless of your political affiliation, don't conflate the issues of our Midwest city with the issues of a Texas mass shooting. In other words, to quote Rex Hupke, keep our city's name out your mouth. I think that's how I envision Rex saying it. I read it today, but that's how he says it. It's been a year since Donald Trump was elected president and 25 years since Bill Clinton was elected president. And what's so different? Smartphones? Wireless headphones? No more hypercolor? Actually, I read an interesting tidbit about George H.W. Bush. No, not about grab-assing, but about how one of the reasons he and Trump have this ongoing feud is because Bush snubbed Trump as his running mate back in 1992. 1992? Wait, I thought Trump was a business guy who just decided to get into politics. Wasn't that the drain the swamp thing? So that's the fake news? Trump's been a national politician since 1992? Just a bad one? Conservatives in the House are calling on Republicans to change a tax reform bill to give more tax breaks to, well, conservatives. They're angry and they're willing to hold up the bill if they don't get what they want. And if they do get what they want, then the moderate Republicans in the House may not go for a tax reform bill. This could be problematic for Republicans. But then again, it seems like the only thing that's not problematic for the Republicans right now are the Democrats. The Senate's about to introduce their plan, which is different, and it doesn't start for a year. Of course. Of course. Look closer to home. Will we see recreational pot on the ballot coming up in 2018? Cook County Commissioner John Fritchie says, let's do it. And President Tony Breckwinkle says, why not? You don't like the soda tax? Here, have some weed instead. Not a bad move to get votes, I guess, right? You wanted to take away soda, but you gave us marijuana? So confused. I wonder when pot is legal and the board passes a big tax on it, will those same actors from the soda tax commercials be back? Weed is my choice for my family. They're killing us with these taxes. Waymo, which I guess is a company, not sure. Yeah. Waymo is about to launch a fleet of self-driving vans. Yep, they're hitting the road soon. This gets big. I mean, which after trying to get on Lower Wacker at rush hour with all the human driving cabs and ride shares cutting you off and acting like they don't see you, I'll take a self-driving car. Although you know those robots are going to get attitude quick. I'm turning here whether you like it or not. Yeah, right back at you, buddy. Want to do something about it? I have a crowbar in my trunk. You know what they should do with those self-driving robots? They should just have the crowbar in it so they don't have to go to the trunk and be like efficient. Just pull it right out. United retired the famed 747 today with one last flight out of San Francisco. I don't make this up. It was delayed. Well, the end of the 747, just think about how many old pieces of gum are under those seats. Nothing worse than an old plane, right? I know we want to get nostalgic about it, but if you're ever on an old plane, you're like, oh, God, this is the worst. So many people sneezed in here. A scientific study says that some of your brain cells get sluggish if you don't get enough sleep. Okay, there was money put into this study? Really? I mean, if you're tired, your brain is tired? Give these guys the Nobel. Strong work, scientists. In weather, gloomy but warmer. Hey, when's the heat wave coming through? Can we get one more patch of 60s before Christmas? Just one, pretty please. Just one. Sports, the Bulls are underway in Toronto. David Nwaba's out for 2 weeks. He was the best Bull so far this season, not named Lowry. Tweaked an ankle. Also, Bobby Portis back from his 8-game suspension. This dude better become the Bulls' star, because if he sucker-punched Nikola Mirotic and then the Bulls just ignored Mirotic's ultimatum about him or Portis, and then he sucks, that would be it for me. You can wear whatever jerseys you want, because I'm not watching anymore. Corey Crawford got another shutout over the weekend, beating the Wild. Nice little run here for the Hawks, huh? Two in a row. Kay Crawford, we see you. We see you. The Hawks don't play again until Thursday. MLB free agency officially underway. The Cubs made qualifying offers to Jake Arrieta and Wade Davis, but that was just to secure draft pick compensation if they walk. I know it seems like a lot of money, but $17 million for Arrieta? I mean, he's looking for so much more, right? Just think of, he's got to grow that beard back, all that facial moisturizer. It's going to cost millions. What else we got here? We're still waiting on the big first move by either the Cubs or the White Sox. Right now, the only moves anyone's predicting is that Arrieta and Wade Davis will walk, while the Sox will try to negotiate not playing next year. Can we just skip to 2019? The winter meetings are coming up soon. That's when we're going to get most of the trade movement. Also, Gold Glove Awards tonight. Hayward, Rizzo, and Zobrist. They're up for one. The Bears watched the Lions maul the Packers last night at Lambeau. Things are dire for the Pack with Aaron Rodgers out. Like I said last night, I'm enjoying it. Stings, doesn't it? Stings. The Bears will host a Pack this weekend, Soldier Field, and for the first time in 9 years, the Bears are favored. What? Man, if this would be the nail in the coffin for John Fox if we lose to a team without a starting QB while coming off a bye, right? I mean, the Packers have lost, what, 3 in a row? If we lose this game, come on, Bears. Must win as you get. And also, the team is 0-2 in the NFC North, so think about that. And finally tonight, how's the Apple iPhone X? Anyone have it? How's the facial recognition? Is it cool? Or is it like Star Trek Next Generation cool? Anyone's face melted off yet? No? I need to know before I invest. Coincidentally, my iPhone 6 is having charging issues. Convenient timing. I know you're listening, Apple. I'm on to you. That's the carry out for November 7, 2017. Since it's been a year since the election, we're giving away President Hillary Clinton cookies that we made up last year. Yeah, they're stale, but let's face it, they were stale last year too. All right, coming up, we'll talk the business of fitness on the Download of Chicago Business. And John Davies joins us at the big table to talk about his new documentary, A City at War, Chicago. Chicago's role in World War II. That plus much, much more tonight. The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm gobbling up my lead here, Justin Kaufman, but it's a big night for Democrats.
Yeah?
Huge.
So here comes all the results on the East Coast. And tell me why I'm supposed to care about this.
Some would say it's a repudiation of our current president. I don't know. That's what they say.
It's funny because I found myself reading, what's going to happen in New Jersey? Yeah. And I was like, we got our own problems.
You know, what's always impressed me about any election night coverage is CNN and John King. This guy works a map like nobody's business.
He's got the big Virginia map up.
Now, check it out here. In this particular block, it's breaking down to three crucial votes between the Miller family and the Johnsons across the street.
Someone should pay attention, like almost, do the old, live blog him and how many mistakes where he has to back out.
Yeah.
Where he hits the wrong county and he has to back out if he does. Because he's flawless.
Yeah.
He's flawless.
He's got like 52 people working for him. He better be.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
All right.
All right. It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business. It is time for the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. It's our weekly segment where we talk with entrepreneurs, CEOs, and small business owners. They share their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, the business of fitness, high-intensity fitness to be exact. Seems like you can't go anywhere without seeing a new gym open up. Could be the mega gyms the size of an old Best Buy, or the gyms that you can't tell are gyms. Is that a coffee shop? A boutique? What is that? Oh, it's a gym. Got it. The one thing that all businesses take away is that working out is a part of life, and there is a need for businesses to offer up those services. Enter Catalin Rodriguez Ogren. Back in 2001, the East Bank Club fitness trainer opened up her own shop in the West Loop called Pow Gym. Pow boasts to be the first woman-owned boxing and MMA gym in Chicago and the most successful youth sports performance program in the country. Did I mention the speed school? I think I mentioned the speed school. The business is growing with a new gym that opened up back in 2016, and Catalin Rodriguez Ogren is still at the helm. She's my guest tonight at the Download of Chicago Business. Catalin, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, so let's get into this. I mean, how hard was it for you to open your own business? Because you were a trainer in Chicago, like I said. Mm-hmm. You work in East Bank Club. You're also doing some writing and other things. Talk about the move to actually get into getting your own space.
Well, I had a really great career at East Bank Club. I was there for 7 years. I got my job there right after college while I was in graduate school. And one of the things that really helped me expand my skill sets over time is that East Bank actually allocated money for education. So I took advantage of that, which was really a cool opportunity. And I had a knack for writing. I started coming up with training concepts that were new at the time. I was teaching kickboxing, and you know, I happened to do this at the time when it was like the beginning of it all.
Right, right.
And then I took it many steps further. I then got hired to write the International Kickboxing Certification Program. And then from there, I got hired to do a 100-city tour across America over 2 years lecturing. So it was just like one building block on top of another. And then I was like, martial arts needs to have more strength training. These two communities need to merge, and we need to integrate and collaborate. And that was the opposite of the martial arts world. It was not a collaborative community. It was
really,
absolutely not. It was very, very isolated.
Yeah.
And I had a really long history in that experience. And, you know, kept bugging an editor of a magazine, and he finally published my first story. And it was about the importance of strength training for martial arts. So that, and then kind of going to the fitness magazines, Home Gym and Fitness published my first story on how kickboxing was the greatest thing in fitness, you know? So I just kind of took it at from both angles, hit it really hard. I was young. I had a ton of energy.
Was the goal to open your own gym? I mean, was that always in the back of your mind? Like, all this stuff is great, and I'm learning so much, and I'm actually paving the way and a pioneer in these fields, but the end
game
is...
Not in the early 90s, no. I mean, I wasn't sure where I was going to go with all of it at the time, especially at the beginning of my career when I started East Bank. I was in Mortal Kombat, so I didn't know if I was going to go down the whole fight choreography path, if I was going to stay in stunt work, you know, kind of, I did all of it because you could.
Right.
And 16-hour days was nothing in my 20s and early 30s. It was just absolutely nothing because every moment was exciting.
Well, you mentioned Mortal Kombat. That was another thing that you were the fight choreographer for the
characters. I played the female characters.
Characters
I played the ninjas.
Too,
yeah.
I think about it because when you made that jump, was it, talk about the fear factor in that, of the idea of having, it seems to me like an ambitious career, a lot of different things that could come up at different times, but the idea of putting yourself in brick and mortar and putting yourself in this is my job and I need to make this work, was that a difficult transition for you?
I definitely knew when I wasn't ready, and I knew when I was. The one thing that I've always been pretty dialed into is when and how to apply myself towards an opportunity. And that's really kind of, I think, been the secret of my success, even since I was a kid. It's like I knew as a youth competitor when I was ready to move up to the higher division. I knew when I was ready to take on another competitive class. You know, I was always pretty good about that. And it always came to me in like, I don't know, I don't want to call it epiphanies, but just moments that just I was like, I don't know, like you take a bite into a sandwich and then all of a sudden you just have a vision and you're like, okay, I'm ready. And then that would be that. And then over time, as you get older, you start trusting that bite into your sandwich,
that
moment, that instinct.
It's interesting because all of that, the instinct and what you're talking about, discipline, it's a huge part of high intensity
disciplined.
Fitness.
Yeah. I mean
that helps. That is it, right? I mean, that's what it's really about.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about making that transition and using those techniques and like you just talked about, biting into the sandwich, those epiphanies, in business.
Yeah. Well, so after East Bank, I moved on and became an independent trainer with colleagues I had met at East Bank that are to this day my closest friend, one in particular, Bernie Lecoq, that owns River North Gym. Having great people around you that also have that entrepreneur energy to help steer you in the right direction was really, really valuable for me. Even though a lot of my friends went off to do different kinds of things in the fitness industry, everybody just really tended to continue lighting the fire under my ambition to do that. But I was, for several years before I opened up POW in 2001, I was being hired by gyms all over the country and the world to come in and tell them how to set up their right. program because they wanted to teach what I taught. So it just kind of finally, over time, I knew that I wanted time covering boxing on the professional circuit. I knew I wanted time to write and to do videos, and I did all that. And then I just kind of got to a point where I was like, I'm ready for a gym. And I really wanted this place where you could do boxing, martial arts, self-defense, high-intensity training, jump rope training. Like, I wanted this place that, what to me, was the perfect place to work out. All these different modalities, super exciting.
How important is that as when you're opening, you're an entrepreneur and you're opening your own business, to diversify like that? Because there'll be some places that this is what they do. They do cross training, or they do this. They might do one of the things you just mentioned. How important, and the challenge of offering all those services?
I think that it's valuable to have that diversification if you have the skill sets in those various diversities. So because I had dedicated at that point, you know, a decade to coming at the industry, the martial arts industry and the fitness industry from both angles, because I wasn't just being hired as a martial art delegate in Taipei, which was an amazing opportunity. I was also presenting at Idea Fitness Conference. So right. I was also at Asia Fit. I was also at in Russia, in Moscow, being brought in to do things. So being able to do things in both communities, and then every time some sort of fun stunt gig just came along, I just kind of did that because it was fun. Right. It just kept everything in my life so dynamic, but I was just such a student of every opportunity I got. I didn't take I didn't lose the advantage and the opportunity when I went to Asia Fit or I went to Idea Fit. Once you're a presenter at these amazing conferences and educational opportunities, you get to do everything for free.
Yeah.
So I was there at the first BOSU launch. I was there when they first brought kettlebells out into the. So I was just like, I'll sign up for it. So I just took everything and anything I could, because what else was I going to do? Go back and watch movies in my hotel room? That just wasn't my personality. So I took advantage of every opportunity that came my way.
Catalin Rodriguez Ogren in studio. She is the founder of POW Gym in the West Loop on South Racine, just south of Jackson. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick break. We'll continue the conversation. When we come back, I want to talk about the challenges, because opening a gym in 2001 is much different than running a gym in 2017, especially with all the high-end competition that's in the city of Chicago. Catalin Rodriguez Ogren, my guest in the Download in Chicago business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. Catalin Rodriguez Ogren in studio tonight. She's the owner and operator of POW Gym. On the west side, we're talking about high-intensity fitness, the merging of MMA and fitness, which you were at the forefront of. In 2017, competition, gyms, boutiques, so many different styles of training. I mean, it just popped up. I mean, just in the last 5 years alone, we've just seen an explosion here in town. How does that affect you as a business owner, as someone who was at the forefront to watch so many different places come in that want a chunk of your business?
Yeah, it's definitely challenging. You know, particularly the West Loop. I will say that the fitness industry in general is moving towards a boutique or niche driven industry. The bigger box gyms are having a harder time. They have to become a little bit more like a health club or country club setting with a mm-hmm. wide range of amenities. But, you know, the niche thing is cool. You know, I think that the difference is that I think you need to know a lot more today in order to open up a business in the city of Chicago.
Just in general as a business owner, or you mean, or in fitness?
Both. I think both areas. I think that a lot of people in the fitness industry today that are opening up niche gyms, they have a very narrow exposure to the fitness industry. You know, where I was really, really lucky that I had this 10-year career at East Bank and traveling the world and teaching fitness, not only kickboxing, but yoga classes and all this. So it made me really diverse. And just the number of hours, you know, sometimes I sit back and I look at how many clients I trained a month and how many classes, and it would be like 37 to 45. And then I'd jump on a plane on Friday morning, and then I would teach till Sunday night and come home and do it all over again. So I don't know if people today are built for that anymore. I don't know. I can tell you what I was built like. I could tell you the discipline that I had. I mean, I was disciplined to the point where I would say, you know what, I'm going to read this book. And I'm not going to bed until I finish this book. And I would read Blue Ocean. And then I would read, you know, Seven Habits. Yeah, and then that was the same thing. I'm going to write tonight. I'm going to write an article until I'm done. That's when I move on.
You know, it's interesting because it's a client-based business and industry, really, if you think about it. And I think about, I mean, if revenue, if you opening a gym, a lot of it is based on the clients coming in. And I would think that, and I can only judge from my own personal experience, that there are sometimes I'm like, I'm going to take this month off, mm-hmm. you know, or I'm not going to train. I'm not going to do this. How fragile is the business model of owning a gym when you have to sort of have a revenue stream that is dependent on people training or working
yeah.
out?
It's absolutely challenging to keep people coming back. I mean, I will say that, you know, we as a business do have a pretty high renewal percentage. Like, I'm a very metrically driven business. So I think there's a misconception that a lot of small businesses are not as metrically driven as like a Best Buy or an Export or whatever the case might be. But I mean, my reporting guides a lot of my decisions, whether I am making huge decisions or small decisions. I am definitely very influenced.
You're doing it by the data, right?
I am. I'm very data driven and I'm very gut driven. I mean, but I've got, you know, 33 years in the martial arts to follow my gut. And I've got a good 20 plus year career in the fitness industry in Chicago to give me a good gut to follow numbers sometimes and sometimes no. And I'm not right all the time. I mean, I kind of, you know, I've made so many mistakes over the years, but I take advantage of those mistakes in a lot of ways. And I take advantage of things that I've done in the city. I've done the 10,000 small businesses business program. I've done grants. I do courses online. I mean, I don't think I know everything.
It's always about continuing your education, not just on the business side, but on the fitness side too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what's the hardest part about running a gym? Is it the trainers? I mean, is it people? And the idea, because I think about you when you were at East Bank, someone to make sure you were doing a good job on behalf of that company or the other company. Is that where it comes down to, the hardest thing about sort of running a gym?
You know, I do refer back to my East Bank days a lot. I really refer back to the way in which I had some really good leaders over there. I didn't interact with, obviously, the executive level people who would be the CEO. Like, I'm technically a CEO, I guess.
Right.
But I had some really great department heads, and they were fun, and they were great listeners, and they seemed really interested in what I had to say. And I actually was really good at understanding when my need wasn't able to be serviced because of something that was above their head. So I think I was really good at setting expectations, and I try to set the correct expectations for my staff.
So you borrow from that experience and flip it as being the boss, right?
Yeah, and you know, at the end of the day, if people are not happy when they walk into work, they're just not going to be an asset to my company. And I think the people that work for me right now are very, very happy people. There is a camaraderie that I think is really unique to our particular gym. And as far as customers go, you know, I just don't get bored of teaching and listening to them. You know, I mean, I try to keep people coming back because I'm taking ordinary people and giving them extraordinary skills. If you can't get high off of something extraordinary that you can do that is a little bit different than the person sitting next to you at work, you weren't going to stay with us anyway. And even though we have this huge strength and conditioning and speed class program, being faster is cooler than being slower. I mean, I don't know.
That's a tagline. That's
yeah.
good.
I mean, our mantra used to be the coolest thing you can learn is martial arts. Just, you know, punch and kick your way here. You know, I mean, that's just kind of like what we are. You know, the punching, the kicking, the self-defense, the speed training. And now, obviously, you know, we still squat and get stronger and push weight like everybody else because that's what that's a baseline. Right.
My last question just is about Chicago. I mean, this is a competitive city, and it gets more and more competitive. You know, if you look at back to 2001, talk about why you stayed here. What is it about Chicago? You grew up here, but to talk about what it is about Chicago that kept you here and keeps you here.
I am loyal to a fault, I guess. I mean, my history here, I was obviously born here. I grew up on Chicago and Wells in my dad's art studio. So I grew up in an environment that wasn't particularly well polished at the time. I mean, Chicago and Wells in 1970 through 1980 was not what River North looks like now. I went to public school, my brothers and I, and I don't know, we're all pretty exposed to great culture and food. And, you know, I think we have a little bit of city addiction.
And I know it well.
Yeah.
Catalin Rodriguez Ogren is the owner and operator of Pow Gym in Chicago's West Loop. Pow Gym is at 310 South Racine, is that right?
Yep.
310 South Racine. Catalin, thanks so much for coming in and being
our
guest on the Download Chicago Business. Appreciate it. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Rob Martyr, what's going on with these elections?
Wow.
Are you paying attention to them?
Sort of. Actually, I am.
So Democrats win in New Jersey and in I don't want to take away your lead stories.
No, not at all. I'm actually not leading with that right now.
Good.
But,
See? That's strong. It's strong.
I took your
advice
last time. I figured out.
We don't care.
You're right. I don't care. I do care in the sense that it is a story. Democrats winning Virginia, New Jersey.
Okay, New Jersey is interesting because that was the state of Chris Christie, right?
Well, and his lieutenant governor was running as well. So you kind of had that ball and chain, I guess, if you will, attached to her.
And then, but in Virginia, that seems to be a Democrat. It's been a Democrat governor for a while, right?
Yeah, you know, some would argue that it could be called a purple state, but you know, it's usually leans blue. So,
what's I'm trying to think. It's interesting to me only because sometimes we whip ourselves into a frenzy around these election results, and then they kind of follow the standard.
I think more than Trump in New Jersey, it certainly was Chris Christie fatigue. Yeah. At least that's just what I'm getting voters.
I got Chris Christie fatigue in Chicago.
Right. you know, and then in Virginia, like you said, I mean, that's usually goes to a Democrat, somewhat a little bit more moderate. So, it's basically Phil Murphy winning in New Jersey. He's a Goldman Sachs guy. Former ambassador to Germany, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And then it's a gentleman by the name of Northam in Virginia who beated Ed Gillespie, the Republican.
It's all about optics, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it gives Democrats, especially in the national level, when they get the midterm, to say, we got this win, we've got momentum, when it really doesn't mean anything.
Oh, they'll take a victory lap, no doubt.
Is the one thing that Lundy said yesterday was that you look at the Virginia House, that they do that everybody's up and it'll give a more of a bellwether to what's going to happen in Virginia. So when those numbers come out, you have a better idea of what people are thinking at the micro level.
Well, certainly we've seen that here. I mean, look, on the state level, it's largely Democratic. Of course, both chambers being controlled by Democrats, and we've got a Republican governor. So there you go.
All right, coming up, John Davies going to join us, a longtime filmmaker and TV producer. He's got a new documentary called A City at War, Chicago. It talks about Chicago and its role in World War II. It's fascinating. I watched it. It's really great. It's stuff I didn't know a lot about, but it gets into not just, you know, obviously the bigger stories about everybody coming together and the wartime production and manufacturing that came out of Chicago, but about the way that the ethnic communities here in Chicago got along at the time, but also about FDR coming to Chicago and giving this sort of rattle the war cage speech at the beginning of World War II. So John Davies, my guest at the big table, that's coming up. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is an award-winning television producer. Got to start right here in Chicago. John Davies is a well-known name from his work on shows like Sneak Previews or Wild Chicago. And he's had a great career in Hollywood, producing and directing award shows and television series like Run's House, or also several documentaries. The last time we heard from John, he was on the show to talk about his film Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan, which aired on public television. And he stayed on topic for his latest project called A City at War, Chicago. It's a one-hour special that looks at Chicago's contribution to World War II, from wartime manufacturing to the Manhattan Project. But it's much more than that. Through archival footage and interviews, we get a more comprehensive look at the politics, the business, and the people during a crucial time in this world's history. The special is going to air on WTTW on the 9th. That's Thursday. And producer and creator John Davies is in studio with us tonight. John, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
I know the Manhattan Project, and we've read all the stories, and many people who are listening right now have lived through the stories of the manufacturing. But it's much more than that. There was political, there was how we lived, the ethnic communities that came together. What drew you to tell this story this way?
When I was making Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan, doing the research for that, which was about how all these planes ended up on the bottom of Lake Michigan through a carrier training exercise. When I was researching that film, I came across some statistics that estimates as much as 30% of everything produced in World War II came out of this time.
Wow.
And I thought, God, that's a staggering
number.
It is,
because you even mentioned in the piece, you talk about the coastal towns. They sort of bared the brunt of a lot of the manufacturing, but Chicago became almost the epicenter after a while.
Chicago and Detroit would be, and some say Detroit even more so because all the auto industry there. But 1,400 companies here retooled literally overnight. If they were making refrigerators one day, they're building Sherman tanks the next. Just so many incredible things happened. For example, the Douglas Company made this transport plane called the C-54 out at Orchard Place.
I was going to ask about that.
The acronym was ORD, O-R-D. Right. When the war was over, because when you build a plane, you have to have a runway for it to take off. When the war was over, the city of Chicago said, hey, we'll buy that from you. And it became O'Hare.
That's amazing.
And then down there in Ford City, where Ford City now is on the south side, that was at one time the largest building in the world. And they were building B-29 engines for the Super Fortress, which carried the bomb to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the bomb developed at University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So Chicago's, there's so many connections to this town. How about the kids? I know you saw the film. One of the things that struck Brian Callies, my partner who made the film with me, as just so sort of disgraceful was we found a book that Adlai Stevenson, when he was governor, commissioned. And this book tells you every single thing that happened in Illinois during World War II. And one of the things it cites is that Illinois was the number one violator of child labor laws. Kids were dropping out of high school to go work in
the
war factory.
And there's a great point in the piece about that, because it was a moment where the country really wanted to push ahead, getting ready for war, and while war was going on, manufacturers were paying good money for people to work in factories, and a kid who was 16, 17 years old could actually get a better paying wage than if he went to college.
Or better pay than his teacher was making. And when we found the film, and I think you probably saw it in the piece, we found a film actually produced by the Illinois School Board, which said, these aren't students, these are war workers. They were training them to build tanks and guns and ships. But the other thing that some of the people who were in the film said to me when we were just talking is they said, you know, John, you know it ended in 1945. We didn't know that. They didn't know. You know, is this going to go on? How long is a world war going to last?
Right.
And is there an end in sight? And I also love the thing that we discovered that 30 minutes after the war was over, all those factories
just
silent.
Stopped production. It's like John Davies in studio. We're talking about his special, which is airing coming up here on the 9th, November 9th. It's called A City at War, Chicago. Let's start at the top. Let's go back to the beginning. One of the earlier scenes in the film showed FDR coming to Chicago to make a speech while they're dedicating a bridge, think over Lakeshore Drive. At the time, Chicago Mayor Edward Kelly was there. They were friends. But there was something about this speech that really becomes the framing of this piece, the idea that this wasn't just sort of, hey, take a look at this bridge. He used it to warn the country, or at least prepare the country, that we were ready for war.
Yeah, it's famously called the quarantine speech. And he had just won re-election, and he had, you know, been re-elected by promising never to go to war again. We're done now with that. But here he was already a year later, telling people, hey, what's going on in Europe is going to come home to roost here. Fascism is spreading. This Hitler's a bad guy. And so he gave this incredible speech here that shocked everybody. And can I just tell you a little bit about the filmmaking aspect of that speech? We went hunting for the footage. Naturally, we found newsreels of it. But then we found a guy in the Library of Congress who said, I have a reel here marked 1937 Roosevelt. Don't know what's on it, but if you guys would be willing to pay for the digitization and give the Library of Congress a drive, I'll send you what's on it. Well, this ended up being color footage.
It's amazing footage, yeah.
And then my partner, Brian Callies, went online and found the whole speech in audio. So now we had newsreel coverage of it, color coverage of it, and the audio, and we were able to put it together. And you've seen it in the film.
Yeah,
it's really kind of
cool. It's really cool, too, not only for history's sake, because it really was a speech that has obviously historical significance, but where it was in Chicago. The idea that there is 1940 or late 30s Lakeshore Drive, there's the president, balloons and people watching, even some of the older footage when you're showing Michigan Avenue and even this building, the Tribune Tower in it. Really a stunning look back on, you know, decades later.
You know, Brian and I have done so much work together now, we really know where to find the footage. I could teach somebody how to do it in a week or so. There's a method to it, and there are certain guys you need to know. There are certain collectors out there where you call them, and they've got it. And one of the things that's happened is that the National Archives and the Library of Congress are now putting high-def copies of as much of their stuff as they can online.
That's a good idea.
So every time Brian and I would buy a film for the National Archives, 2 weeks later, here it is online free.
Just a little bit off.
But we always paid for the HD transfer. Do you want to hear just one?
Yeah, hold on. Let me do this. Let's take a quick break so we stay on time tonight. In studio tonight, John Davies. It's his new project, A City at War, Chicago. It's about Chicago during World War II. It's going to air on TTW coming up here on Thursday the 9th. All right, John, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. We're talking with John Davies, longtime television producer and director and writer. He's done so many great things here in Chicago and in Hollywood, but he's got a new film series special called A City at War, Chicago, which is going to air on TTW on the 9th this coming Thursday. And it's about Chicago's contribution to World War II. Politics, is, we talked about FDR and that speech. And what I love about it is that it obviously means a ton to the country. But it also means a ton to Chicago because of his relationship with then-Chicago Mayor Edward Kelly. They were friends, FDR
yes.
and Edward Kelly. So Chicago almost, you could feel from the film that Chicago has this pride in the fact that he made this speech here and it's time to mobilize. And Mayor Kelly had a lot to do with that.
He did. He helped sell the message in one of the third largest city in the country at the time, still is. They were tight, and they also had another agenda. Kelly knew that once Pearl Harbor happened, everybody knew that this money would be unleashed to convert these factories, and he knew he'd have a ton of jobs. This is after sort of a famine in the job area because of the Great Depression.
Right, right.
So Kelly and Roosevelt realized, you know, we could really get the black community in Chicago fully employed and maybe convince them to move from the party of
Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln,
which were the Republicans, right,
over to the Democratic side. So they had another agenda. You know, he wanted to solidify Chicago as a Democratic stronghold. And it still is.
And that message worked. I mean, the idea of going to the black community saying, I'm going to have all these jobs, you should come out, you should work in these jobs. Not only that, it's fascinating to me as you look back on what was happening here in Chicago and across the country. But here in Chicago, Chicago is always known as a city of neighborhoods. There's a lot of ethnicities. There's different places and many different backgrounds affected by what was happening overseas, whether it be the German-Americans, Polish-Americans, Japanese-Americans, and we've heard all these stories. But in Chicago, you think about those groups, and that makes up a big part of who we are as a city of Chicago. Talk about that. Talk about the ethnic identity and how they were responding in Chicago to what was happening in the lead-up to World War II.
Yeah, I mean, we made a special effort to figure that out, and so we knew the story for the Jewish community was going to be important, for example. Were Chicago Jews in the 30s aware of what was going on in Germany? You bet they were. And they had come here, those who were lucky enough to get out had come here early, and they, you know, were trying to get everybody's attention. Hey, this guy Hitler's bad news. And they managed to do that. So they were super involved in the war effort. The Polish community, because so much of it is Jewish, of course, they were very involved in the war effort. The black community had a little less of a stake. It's the same thing that happened, you know, with Muhammad Ali in Vietnam. You know, those Viet Cong have never called me the N-word. To get loyalty from a group of your countrymen who don't feel like they're being treated well in their own country is kind of tough. And, of course, when black soldiers and women signed up, it was segregated. The military was 100% segregated. And then even in the factory work, they were kind of given jobs that, you know, weren't quite as...
Or less than.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And so that was a concern for that community. I get into the Greek community for two reasons. One, I've been friends for years with Harry Mark Petrakis, and I knew he had been stamped 4F and couldn't serve. And so he said he didn't do anything in the war, but he did. He took it all in, and he's a tremendous observer of life. And I knew he'd deliver about five or six incredible sound bites. And he and Marty Robinson, I think, are the heart of the film, because Marty also is a great storyteller. Marty being the voice of Channel 11 for 25 years, a legendary Chicago broadcaster. Some of this, by the way, this film, this is my salute to the old guard guys that I knew here. And I'm getting old, too.
But it is you feel it. You feel the spirit of listening to people who lived it, who lived in World War II or the lead up to that. And we're here in Chicago. As a Chicagoan now in 2017, there's something fascinating to me to look at Navy Pier or to look at Michigan Avenue or to look at the different people who are talking about their own childhood who we've listened to or interacted with as Chicagoans for years. There is a spirit. Is that what you're going for, the spirit of the history of this town?
Well, one of the things we say at the end of the film is that today we're fighting wars, what is it, on 11 fronts or something like that, and most people just don't really, they're not aware of it, and they're not thinking about it unless you're a soldier or you're a family member of a soldier. But then, everybody was involved, men, women, children, and there was a spirit. It might have been one of the few times in American history where everybody realized we've got to get together.
And a lot of it, when you said as well in the piece, is that this is a war they could lose, that we could lose.
Yes.
The idea that this is not like in Vietnam, that was really never a consideration, or even Iraq. So you can understand why a disinterested, you know, society, as you point out in the more current wars. But in World War II, there was a fear that Germany would sweep through Europe. There was a fear that Japan would sweep through Asia, and they would be on both coasts in a number of years.
Well, as crazy as it sounds, too, you know, Roosevelt was so aware of how quickly the Germans could hop, skip, and jump here with certain islands they could get to. And they were also worried about this super bomber that could come over the pole maybe and bomb. So the idea of Chicago being bombed sounds crazy. But when you find out later in post-war, all the plan, they had that New York bomber that was going to make it round trip from Berlin to New York and drop a giant payload on Manhattan. I mean, those things could have happened. This was somebody who had to be stopped. These were two identifiable, very easily identifiable enemies, the Germans and the Japanese, at that time. Now, we also tell the story of the Japanese lady who came here as a child. I think that's a fascinating story. They, you know, they interned all these Japanese on the West Coast because they were kind of rightfully worried a little bit, because they discovered later in Pearl Harbor that there had been some
saboteurs
there. Right. So anyway, they interned all these Japanese, and they decided after processing that 20,000 could be relocated to Chicago. It was in far inland enough. And they came here, and that's really the beginning of the Japanese community here in Chicago. Right. And we had Jean Mishima in our film. She was brought here as a little girl. But boy, she remembers it. She remembers being relocated and forced into these new environments. But that whole area up there by Belmont and Clark, that's a little that was a little nook.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get the news. And we'll come back and we'll continue, because I want to talk about the people of Chicago. Everything from the high school students we mentioned, or women coming into the workforce, or rations. We didn't even talk about rations. All these words, I'm sure, grabbing the memory bank for people who are listening right now. John Davies is an award-winning television producer. His newest project, A City at War, Chicago, is going to air on Thursday on WTTW, which looks at Chicago and wartime, pre-wartime, World War II. John Davies, my guest. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, the award-winning television producer, John Davies. John Davies, long time here in Chicago, and of course in Hollywood. He's done so many different things, and he has a new project which is going to be airing on Thursday called A City at War, Chicago, which looks at Chicago during World War II. And a lot of it is kind of mentioned right at the top. It really does go into pre, during the war, and a little bit of post about what happens when the factories shut down minutes after the victory is declared. But let's talk about the people, because and what life was like, because I guess I'm a little bit embarrassed that I didn't know this, because I'm sure my dad lived through it, and my mom lived through it. Everyone lived through this, and I just didn't know the story. The kids, we talked about the kids, you know, getting out and working in factories, but there also was this concerted movement for scrapping. for we need everything on deck. Go get the tires. Move, you know, every kid, they were organizing from the elementary school almost. This idea that this was war effort was almost a grade. You know, like there was algebra, there was history, you know, and there was war effort. Talk about that, because that's something that you don't necessarily hear all the time. And Chicago really bought into that.
Well, people talk about rationing back then, and they don't talk about it with fond memories. I mean, suddenly everything that you had in your life was going to be limited. Butter was going to be limited. Eggs, flour, gasoline, tires, dresses, fabrics. It invaded every aspect of your life. And if you're living in a country like America where we're used right. to having anything we want whenever we want, I mean, can you imagine that being implemented today? There'd be, and of course, human beings are going to find a way around things, and they did.
It's black market, right.
Black market was a big thing, and one of the big things that the mob in town, or the outfit as you guys call them here in Chicago, they were after the gas rationing books. There was a lot of dough in that. You know, when you have limited tires and limited gas rationing, you're not going that far. And you wouldn't just get a speeding ticket back then. If you were speeding, you were wasting valuable fuel. You could get jail time.
Yeah, and they'd take away your gas car.
They'd take away your gas car. You wouldn't be driving anymore. But the mob put their fingers in a lot of stuff here. They also noticed one day that there are 40,000 young men passing through town on a regular basis with needs.
Now, well, let's talk about that. Obviously, Great Lakes Naval Academy, Navy Pier, other places, there was a lot of training facilities that were happening here in Chicago to get cadets or officers or soldiers ready for war. That meant that Chicago had a lot of servicemen in town. And Mayor Kelly saw that as an opportunity.
Well, Mayor Kelly actually ran the nicer spots where you'd meet that down-home girl and she'd bake you a cookie or something. You'd do a little dancing with her. But there were some guys that wanted a little more action than Mayor Kelly was willing to provide. I'm sure Mayor Kelly might have had a share of this other action,
I think
too,
he probably did.
Him, but,
yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, prostitution was big. Gambling was big. They were going to download these guys of every last dollar before they left town, some of them very willingly. But Mayor Kelly also, along with the Navy, they grabbed a stretch of Lakeshore Drive, and you can still see that building out there on Lakeshore Drive. I think would it be just below, not Division,
but
it's just a few miles up on the right. It's still what's left of it. And this was like a country club for sailors. And I love the footage we found of this place. I mean, there were like all these beautiful girls would walk you around and talk to you. You're allowed to put your arm around their waist.
They just essentially seized lakefront property and made acres and acres of a resort like for soldiers who were getting ready to go out. Not only that, but hotels, food, everything was free. Mayor Kelly was doubled down on the idea that we're going to take care of these soldiers before they go to war. And when they come back, It's amazing to think that so much was given to a soldier before they went to war.
One of the guys we interviewed said to me, too, he said they thought that after the end of the war, there'd be another big depression. But what the war had done was it had geared everything up. You know, people learned how to produce and produce at an incredible rate. It really is the beginning of us becoming a superpower all over America, not just Chicago. And so the Great Depression they thought was coming never came. It's the beginning of our rise, actually. And I think it blew away our allies, just how much we could produce, because that's what won the war.
But
production won the war.
Production won the war. And you look at it, and you look at how Chicago was mobilized. And like you said, 30% of the production came out of just this one city. And Detroit
is
an estimate. But also Detroit. But the idea that we could mobilize like that for one cause, this patriotic, unified cause, you know, the threat was there. But, I mean, it's hard to believe that the country could be unified like that, for one thing, and be able to get that kind of production. Women going into the workplace, kids being used 9, 10 years old to say, go over to that scrap heap, get as much metal as you can out of it. We're going to need that metal. Something about it that is just foreign to anyone who lives in 2017.
One of the things that I learned making this film, radio, for example, was a big part of the unification. Because every night people would sit around, they'd get the update on the war, how we were doing. They'd share that, you know, you'd listen to your favorite shows, many of which came out of Chicago, produced here, but went national. Radio was a big unifying force. I don't know what it would take today to get people with opposite political views together on the level that they were during World War II. I don't know what motivating factor there would be. Back then, and even in my generation, you know, I'm a Democrat. I had tons of Republican friends. Boy, that's getting further and further away in life. You hang with your own crowd. And so something had to come along as big as this to get everyone to look around and say, we got to stop squabbling amongst ourselves. because there was drastic and radical debates going on before we got in the war. The newspaper publishers in this town were split. Some of them wanted to get involved. Right. Others didn't.
McCormick at the Tribune had a big part, yeah.
Here's a great McCormick story I didn't have a place for in the film. But after the Battle of Midway, a big famous Pacific battle where we did very well with the Japanese, McCormick runs a story saying we cracked the Japanese code, their naval code. Roosevelt is furious. He's going to order troops to storm Tribune Tower and arrest McCormick. Now, cooler heads prevailed, and thank God nobody read that article that had a hard line to the Japanese hierarchy, because that would have really screwed us. It was a serious, serious breach of secrecy, and that didn't happen. But the other thing I found out is that McCormick and Roosevelt went to prep school together. And they weren't exactly chummy in prep school.
But
I did find nice letters between them. Like, I found a letter where McCormick said, "I hear you're coming to Chicago. You're welcome to stay at our home." And Roosevelt politely declines. So they knew each other a long time. But they had polar opposite political views. And after Pearl Harbor, everybody fell in line.
I mentioned at the top that you did your film Heroes on Deck, World War II in Lake Michigan. I had you in here. We talked about what you learned from that experience, because really there was so much training happening on Lake Michigan with the two aircraft carriers, essentially, that were practice. I forgot the names, but they parked next to Navy Pier, and they would practice, and that's why we have so many.
The Sable and the Wolverine.
Yeah, the Sable and the Wolverine. After this, and having the opportunity to sit down and go through all this archival footage and talk to different people, what have you learned about Chicago that you didn't already know? Because you're a longtime guy. You've worked here. You've known Chicago. What about this project hit the light bulb?
I know I'm coming back here to retire. I'm going to move from L.A. back here because I just think the stories here are so great. You know, I'm sort of unhappy that I'm this old because I'm just getting rolling on this. I mean, I did Funny Business about Chicago's only black-owned nightclub and Heroes on Deck. And I got a lot more. And I just feel like it's too bad I'm in my 60s now, because I wish I was thinking like this in my 40s, because I could end up with a huge body of Chicago work. And also, the other thing I like about them is we try and make our films high quality enough that they can go national. And whenever somebody says to me, "Oh, that's a Chicago story that'll just play local," wait a second. Every story has a home.
Yeah.
I watch films about interesting stories that took place in Portland, Oregon.
Right.
I'm not so myopic that if it doesn't relate to my block, I can't watch it. And neither is the viewing audience. So this will go national.
Because, as I mentioned earlier, it is a national story. Chicago had such a national presence in World War II, even from the beginning speeches of FDR.
Well, I hope that you noticed in the film, we call this episode one of a series, and I'm in discussions with the other seven or eight U.S. cities that had as much to do with the war, as much as we did. Sometimes very different things that they did. And I'm trying to reach out to filmmakers there and the PBS stations there and say, look at this as kind of a template. Why don't you guys tell your city story? I'm not looking for any money from it. I'm just saying, let's do City at War Detroit, City at War Manhattan, City at War San Diego. I'd be fascinated.
Yeah.
Every city went through something different. Every city had something to offer that the other city didn't.
Does Chicago do a good enough job of preserving all of these sites and history that's here, whether it be the building that I think you're talking about, the Theater on the Lake building in that area,
which we don't know has
anything to do with. I love the marker that looks beat up of where the radiation stuff is in the southern and the south side
Manhattan
preserve.
Project nuclear waste.
It's, you look at these and you go, I can't believe that's here. It's so stunning. Does Chicago do enough to commemorate their place in World War II?
If you want to find this stuff, it's easily findable. And Brian Cowley's my partner on the project. We used to have a big section at the end that showed you tons of stuff, because there's a ton of history out there. And you could kind of do a, you know, if this idea took off, because, you know, most young people are looking forward. They're not looking backwards. You're not looking at the past. But you could paint a bus, you know, in World War II colors or something, and you could spend 16 hours going to all these. There's tons and tons of stuff left. For example, sitting out there in Park Forest is the old Amertorp Torpedo Company, where they made about 60% of all the torpedoes used in World War II. Now it's a shopping mall and a church. But you can still see the Albert Kahn design if you go around the back. And Albert Kahn, by the way, this is a guy who built almost every war production plant in the United States. Mm-hmm. And why did he get the job? Because he was Henry Ford's guy. He's at the birth of mass production, Albert Kahn. Yeah. His buildings are all over this town.
That's fascinating.
And by the way, the guy died in 1945, before the war was over, and he was in his 60s or something. This guy was making $475,000 a year in 1944. Can you imagine?
Ah, that's a lot of money.
You buy a house for like $4,000 or something.
John Davies, my guest, the television producer, director, and writer. His new project, A City at War, Chicago, will air this Thursday, the 9th on WTTW. And we look forward to many, many more projects. John Davies, thanks for being my guest. I appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Justin.
Great to have John in studio talking about his documentary, which comes out on Thursday, 8 o'clock on Channel 11. Got a lot of texts that we're asking about. Channel 11, 8 o'clock Thursday to see the City at War Chicago documentary. Tomorrow night on this program, we're going to continue our World War II week. We're going to talk with a Holocaust survivor, Aaron Elster from Lincolnshire, Illinois. He's a part of the Illinois Holocaust Museum's new Take a Stand Center, which features holograms of 13 Holocaust survivors telling their stories. They took 13 survivors to a studio, asked them over, 2,000 questions. And it's a new exhibit at the museum in Skokie where you can go in and talk to the hologram, ask the hologram questions. And because of the questions they've answered before, technology, they're able to do this. This is a way for the Holocaust Museum, not just here, but in the U.S., the one in Washington, to preserve some of the stories from the Holocaust as people who survived it pass on. And so we'll talk with Aaron Elster tomorrow night at the big table about his story in a Polish labor camp at the age of 10 years old. Being separated from his family and escaping and living in an attic, not unlike the famed story, of course, but living in an attic and escaping Nazis during that invasion. So Aaron Elster will be our guest at the big table. It's some powerful, powerful stuff. So we'll have that conversation tomorrow night. And then we continue, which has kind of become I would say a de facto, I don't want to say it's like Vet Week because it's Veterans Day coming up here this week. And we had a conversation tonight about World War II. Tomorrow, the Holocaust, of course, was associated with World War II. But we'll talk with Dr. Michael Mann, who has written a book about his experiences at the VA in San Francisco. He was involved with the VA back in 2014 when they had the controversies. And essentially a book where, and I'm reading it now because he's going to be on the show Friday. It's a conversation about why service, customer service, I would call it just care, treatment and care, is so backwards at the VA and why it has been and why there's such wait times are so long for veterans to get health care. What it turns out to be is just a situation where data and statistics become more important than the actual lives of the veterans. That's what Dr. Mann's talking about in San Francisco, being a part of the VA there in San Francisco back in 2014. And that's where it went awry, where statistics and being able to tell a story through statistics and data that they were doing their job and serving veterans actually got in the way of serving veterans. And we'll talk about that and how the VA is such a huge, it's amazing the stats in this book. And I don't have them off the top of my head because the book's at home, but it's just amazing how many veterans go through the VA system here in this country and all the different treatments and healthcare that's provided. It's staggering, the number. And it's obviously very important, especially when you're talking about some of the things that when you have to deal with war associated injuries and emotional injuries as well as PTSD, that it's crucial to get it right. So we'll talk about that coming up here on the download this week. So that's sort of our, I would say, a default Veterans Week. That's good. Yeah, I don't think we didn't cut promos for it all this week, but we are bringing you some of those conversations. Coming up at 9 o'clock hour tonight. You guys ready for this? Marcus Wicker will be with us, the poet, who is a national award-winning poet, has a new collection of poems called Silencer. Be in a conversation about how his identity. He's black. He grew up in Midwest in Michigan. Talked to him about how that experiences childhood, how he reflects that in his poetry, which takes on issues like gun violence, but also police brutality, inequality in his poetry. So we'll talk to him about that. Also coming up, I know you guys have been waiting for this because I've seen the text. We will talk with the Chicago Botanic Gardens. Andrew Bunting will be here to talk about not only lawn care, trees, flowers, plants, gardens, and how you get ready for the winter and making sure they're there, but what went wrong with my hydrangeas? Sort of an exit interview, the summer of 2017, and why Justin's hydrangeas didn't bloom. Yeah. I don't want to get started. I guess I just don't have the right people like Ro.
Yeah, you need a service.
I can't believe he said that with a straight face. He's like, well, my hydrangeas were perfect. I mean, they're still bloomed. I mean, I remember when my people came over to set it all up for me. Whoa. What does that mean? It's just like, I don't have anyone setting up for me. I'm out there digging the hole myself.
Yeah, you're doing it.
I'm doing it.
Green thumb.
Yeah, sort of. Right. The one thing I will say, though, for longtime listeners of The Download, is I was successful in curbing my rabbit problem.
Oh.
Remember, I got really mad because
they were eating everything.
And we had little babies in our yard, a little foyer yard. Mm-hmm. This year, at the beginning of the year, and I took the advice of the Chicago Botanic Gardens, they said, you need to treat that when the flowers go in. So when I put the flowers in the spring and did the whole thing, we treated, put marigolds around, we sprayed, we did the whole thing, and they just ignored us. They stayed away. It may have helped that I rounded them all up and then went four doors over. Dropped them into my neighbors. I may or may not have done that. You don't have proof. There's no cameras. But, yeah, so the rabbit situation was taken care of, but the hydrangeas didn't work.
Yeah, you're not going to be a stop in any garden walk, it doesn't sound like, yet. Maybe next year.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I should. Maybe that's the plan. Maybe that's the goal, like to get on a garden walk.
Yeah.
Right?
Get in there. Get people digging through. Looking at your stuff.
Like we heard Catalin in the Download Chicago Business talking about that instinct, the challenge when you're ready for a challenge.
Yeah, there you go.
Maybe that's it. Maybe I just need to step up to the challenge and say, hey, I'm going to be ready for next year. I'm going to have the best garden. I'm going to apply right now for Garden Walk.
There, my wife's father, he was out doing something in his backyard, and he noticed some guy peeking in, like looking at his lawn, and like he went to inquire, and the guy was like, "Yeah, like I'm from the Evanston Chamber of Commerce or whatever. I'm searching for the people for the next garden walk."
Bogus.
And that it kind of lit a fire under him to make sure everything was up to snuff, and because he wants to be part of the garden walk.
That's that peeping Tom's excuse. I'm with the Evanston Chamber of Commerce. We're looking at the gardens and lawns. That's why I'm peeking through your fence. It's a spectacular garden. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's that time of year where we have to spend a couple hours on the weekend closing up shop for the winter. So your lawns, your gardens, flower beds, trees, and shrubs, they got to be treated for the rough conditions that lie ahead, at least until climate change makes our winters 70 degrees. I'm sure that's coming up soon. So you ready? You got any questions of what you need to do for certain plants and flowers that you lovingly took care of this summer? 312-981-7200. Now's the time. In studio, Andrew Bunting. He's the assistant director at the Chicago Botanic Gardens, as well as the director of plant collections there. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I got to start because I've been complaining all night about my hydrangeas, and I've already gotten great response from the listeners here at WGN, although very varied response in the way that six or seven things, you know, certain species don't bloom every year, not enough sunlight, not enough fertilizer. I got everything in between. But I got to tell you, I was very upset that this year I was ready to, I built the whole thing, my whole garden, everything about my little flower garden was all about those being the centerpiece and they didn't come up. What did I do wrong?
So you have a couple hours. So where I used to work, which was an arboretum out on the East Coast, we used to get a lot of questions from homeowners, and the number one question was always, "Why aren't my hydrangeas flowering?"
Ah.
So you're not alone.
Yeah.
And probably the reasons might be multifold, but most likely it's because you probably have either a pink or a blue, of course. So the first thing to know about the pink and the blue hydrangeas is you can have, let's just take an example. There's a hydrangea called Forever Pink. In the Midwest, it will be forever pink. So in soils where the pH, determines whether the soil is acidic or alkaline.
Yeah.
So in the Midwest, it's typically alkaline. So when the soil is alkaline, the hydrangeas are pink.
Okay.
On the East Coast, it's more acidic soils. The hydrangeas tend to go blue.
Really?
So
I would have just thought someone spray painted those flowers. No, a certain,
if it's a pink or blue one, it can be pink or blue depending on the acidity of the soil.
Yeah.
So out east, I bought this one called Forever Pink. Well, it was Forever Pink for like the first summer, and then every summer after that was blue. So,
wow, okay.
So that's one thing that probably has nothing to do with why your hydrangea didn't flower.
I blame it on the rabbits.
Right.
I'm not going to lie to you.
Well,
it could be
the rabbits. So. With those types that are pink or blue, and they can either be a big ball or kind of a flat-topped cluster of flowers, they need stems that are 2 years old, that have two-year-old stems on which to flower. So if your rabbits are eating them to the ground every year, they grow back in the spring.
Really?
They get, let's just say, 2-3 feet tall. Well, those stems are only a year old, and they won't produce flowers. So then they get chewed to the ground again. And so every year you only have, we call the stems wood. You only have one-year-old wood. You really need two-year-old wood to produce the flowers.
You're blowing my mind here.
There is a way around it.
Okay.
So there is a group of hydrangeas that have come out that can bloom with those blue or pink flowers on one-year-old stems. So a popular group is like the Endless Summer series. So those are kind of flat-top clusters. Here would be pink versus blue in more acidic areas. So that might be something you want to consider. And then the other thing, if you don't mind changing colors, so if you like white hydrangeas, probably the most common white hydrangea all through the upper Midwest is one called Annabelle.
Okay.
And Annabelle blooms on new stems or new woods. So with Annabelle, your rabbits could chew it to the ground. You could cut it to the ground, let it grow up to 3 to 4 feet, and then in July be covered with huge kind of snowball white flowers. So
I totally know what's up now because I think we cut it to the ground thinking that it would be the next year, it would come back up like a normal kind of thing.
And it came back with the green.
It had all the green leaves,
yep.
But those pink flowers didn't come out.
Yeah. And another thing that happens is a lot of those types are not hardy enough for some of our winters. So say if we get a really cold winter, those stems will actually die to the ground. And they'll still, the plant never dies. The plant always comes back. So it's this... plant where, it has this luxuriant, bold foliage, and you think, wow, it's going to bloom this year.
Well,
and then,
I blame myself.
Nothing.
I mean, I went to a nice greenhouse, got them, but then I did that thing, that macho thing where I'm like, I'm not going to ask any questions about this. I'm going to act like I know. I'm going to have like the confidence to walk up to the register like, I'm a hydrangea guy. I'm not going to ask any questions. So I blame myself for that. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
now I have all these
hydrangeas.
This is perfect.
You're not the only one that's had their heart broken over them.
Andrew Bunting in studio. He is the assistant director at Chicago Botanic Gardens. All right, let's talk about, there's obviously, that's my issue, hydrangeas, and you solved it. That's the mystery. We have it. But there are a lot of other issues as we get to. You don't think necessarily about gardening or flowers or trees in November, of course. But this is an important time of year to get your area ready for winter.
Right. So, you know, things you can do this time of year is kind of what we call kind of putting the garden to bed. So, you know, as we get cold temperatures, a lot of your perennials will just start, you know, turning black or going off color. And my approach is that anything that's not ornamental looking anymore, I'll cut it to the ground if it's a herbaceous perennial. If it still has fall interest, like a lot of the ornamental grasses still have fall interest.
You mean if it looks good for
the
fall?
Yeah, if it still looks good.
Right, right.
You know, because this time of year, you don't have the abundance of flowers and berries and foliages that you necessarily have in the summertime. So you need to be a little bit more choosy in what you decide to cut to the ground. But eventually, it'll get really cold. Everything will discolor from a perennial point of view, and you'll start to cut all that to the ground. So let's just assume you have an area, you've cut most everything to the ground. Now's a good time to maybe put on a little bit of mulch. So at the Botanic Garden, we're putting on right now about 2 to 3 inches of leaf compost. This could also be composted bark chips. It could be a mulch that you buy at the garden center. So we put that down as a layer that gives it kind of like a protective, insulative blanket for the winter time.
Okay.
And it's also now's a great time, in addition to doing kind of putting your garden to bed for the winter, it's also time to plant bulbs. So you might like tulips or daffodils or snowdrops.
So you plant them now.
You plant them now, right. Huh. So, you know,
so they're going to come up in the spring.
In the spring.
I'm new to this. I had no idea, but my neighbors had these beautiful tulips, I think they were. They're beautiful. Yeah. Next to me. And my wife told me, because she's not new to this, she's like, those die after in the spring. Yeah. They're only a spring flower, right? You're not going to see them in the summer. I'm like, what a waste.
Yeah.
Like, I got mad. I'm like, that's not even – what's the point then?
Yeah, so tulips are almost like an annual. So annuals, you know, once they – like this time of year again, they're getting frosted, and you just pull those out of the ground. With tulips, you plant them in the fall. They come up, look amazing in the spring, but then they're really, you should almost treat them like an annual. You can leave them in, and they'll come back, but it's kind of diminishing returns each year. They get weaker and weaker and weaker. Mm. But things like daffodils and hyacinths and snowdrops and snowflakes, you know, if you put in a bulb this fall, comes up next spring, maybe you get a few flowering stems, but then every subsequent year, the mass will get bigger and bigger and bigger. And for somebody like you that has rabbits, things like snowdrops, snowflakes, squills, daffodils are all rabbit-proof.
Love it. Andrew Bunting in studio from the Chicago Botanic Garden. Let's do this. We'll take a break.
Sure.
We'll come back. Let's talk about lawn care, trees, shrubs as we get ready to essentially shut it down for winter. We're talking everything green tonight here on The Download. Stay with us. We're talking all things green as we get our yards and our lawns and our, in my case, my little foyer ready for the winter time. Andrew Bunting in studio. He is the assistant director over at Chicago Botanic Gardens, also director of the plant collection there. And we talk about getting ready. I am already, my light bulbs are going off, bulbs, about getting some bulbs in the ground in November. So you think the whole month of November I can go to the garden centers and other places, get some bulbs for the spring and start working right now?
Yeah, I mean, your real window of opportunity for planting bulbs, I would say, be mid-October to mid-November. But since we've had a relatively mild fall, I think you could probably get away with planting bulbs through November. What will happen is, in the general rule of thumb when planting bulbs, if you have a bulb that's, say, 2 inches in length, you want to plant it 2 to 3 times its length. So a 2-inch bulb, 4 to 6 inches.
Okay.
And put the, if you know what the right side is, up, put that up.
Uh-oh. it's not my strength.
Right. But it's pretty straightforward.
All right, okay.
With most bulbs. So it usually has a tapered top, and that's usually the top of the bulb.
The other thing I think about, and I know I live in the city and I live on a tree-lined street. What do you have to do if you own a trees, you have them in your yard, people listening right now? What kind of proper maintenance or preventative maintenance do you have to go through with trees and shrubs when you get ready for the winter?
So if it's an established tree, assuming we've had a reasonable amount of moisture, rain, which we have
yeah.
You really shouldn't have to do anything. But if you've just planted, say, a new shrub or a new tree, what you want to do as we move into fall is make sure it's well watered moving into the fall. You don't want it overly saturated. The last thing you want to do with any tree or shrub is water it too much, but you also, conversely, don't want it to go into the late fall and winter bone dry. So you want the roots well hydrated. And for a new shrub or tree, I'd also do some mulching at the base of it. So maybe 2 to 3 inches of composted bark mulch, or it could be a shredded hardwood bark mulch. And what that does is it helps hold the moisture around the base of the tree for the winter. It also gives a little bit of insulation if we have an exceptionally cold winter. And as far as tree and shrub planting, you can continue that for deciduous plants, so trees and shrubs that lose their leaves, you know, probably well into the middle of December.
Okay. All right. So, I'm feeling good. There's a lot of options here. all right. I don't have a lawn.
Yeah.
It's not my area of expertise, but I know a lot of people listening do. Lawn care, preventative, or getting the lawn ready, the grass ready for the winter. What do you have to do there?
So same thing. You want to make sure it's at least hydrated going into the winter. You can also do an organic slow release nitrogen fertilizer. Most our soils around here are often fairly high in phosphorus and potassium, but a little bit of nitrogen will kind of green up the lawn going into the winter. As we start getting frost, like a heavy frost where you see the lawn is kind of white, you really want to avoid walking on the lawn, because what it will do is those blades of grass are they're frosted and they're hard. They're almost frozen. So you walk on the lawn and you're actually breaking the blades of grass. And then what you'll see is if it warms up during the day and a few days go on, if the grass is still a little bit actively growing, you'll actually see brown patches kind of where you've stepped on the lawn.
You know, I think the legend and the lore of the old man, Mr. Baker getting mad and yelling kids to get off the lawn, now you understand why.
Right.
I mean, there it is. They work hard to get those blades. Get off my lawn. You're like, you're just out of touch, old man. But really, it's true. It's breaking the lawn. All right, so the other question I would have, and I have some questions, too, from listeners, but before we get there, is the idea of bringing plants inside.
Sure.
Or the idea of having plants indoors. Do you recommend that? Like, if somebody has a plant that's usually outside, do you uproot it and bring it inside?
Well, I wouldn't bring in like a shrub or a perennial, something that's kind of permanently growing in the garden. But a lot of us, and I did this as a kid growing up, I had house plants that I would nurture throughout the winter. Got warm enough, I would take them outside for the summertime. So, I have a fond memory of bringing like a jade plant out, or one of the classic examples is a fig tree. Ficus benjamina. So it's out for all the summer. It's getting cool. So right now it's cold enough. You definitely want to be bringing it in. You probably should have thought about bringing it in maybe a couple weeks ago. So what happens, though, inevitably, is you bring in this beautiful plant that's enjoying our nice, hot, humid summers. You bring it in. So it goes from a very humid, fairly warm atmosphere to a fairly, your house may still be warm, but it's going to be dry. So that change in humidity, often what happens is you either get a yellowing of the leaves, sometimes the leaves start to fall off, but that's actually kind of the plant's way of adapting to these new kind of climatic conditions. So you may have some distress to the plant. It will recover. If you can, with a lot of these kind of tropical house plants, if you can give them a little bit of humidity, maybe bring them into the bathroom from time to time, even put them in the shower and give them some kind of top watering and humidity.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, with some of the smaller plants, if you have a saucer with which they might sit in, you don't want them sitting in standing water, but you can put some gravel in the saucer, sit the plant on top of the gravel, put some water amongst the gravel, and a little bit of humidity comes up. Another thing you really have to watch for is, so again, your plant's been outside all summer long. You bring it in, and maybe it's cool now. You bring it into a fairly warm condition, and unbeknownst to you, things like spider mites and white flies have laid eggs on your plant. You bring them into this nice warm home environment, all of a sudden you have a cloud of white flies, or you have little tiny red
spider-like
creatures.
Or maybe like a Christmas Vacation, a squirrel.
Right. So in the case of that, what I would do is, you know, go to the hardware store or to your garden center and get an insecticidal soap. So this is, you know, very low toxicity. It's essentially soap. You spray it on the white fly, spider mites, aphids. You may have to do it repeated times, but the last thing you want to do is be spraying something toxic to kill the insects in your house.
All right, real quick, let's get through this because we're running out of time here. Rose bushes. What about rose bushes? Do rapid fire. What about rose bushes?
So rose bushes, because we have fairly cold winters, you want to mulch around the base, maybe about a third of the way up the stems, again with a shredded bark mulch.
Okay. 312 says, I rescued a ginkgo seedling growing along the curb about a month ago, placed it in a patio pot. It's four leaves big, still on, turning yellow now. What's the best way? Same thing as you were just talking about?
Yellow. It's a deciduous tree. It turns yellow in the fall. They'll want to kind of overwinter it in that pot, but if they just keep it on their patio, in the pot, it'll get too cold and die. So what I would do is dig a hole in the ground, put the pot in the hole in the ground, put a little bit of mulch around it, and then pull the pot out in the spring, and it should be alive.
There you go. Bulb question. I have had much success in the past with new regulations. I'm having trouble getting anything to grow with these new CFLs. What are CFLs? Water, soil, wattage?
Yeah. Don't know.
All right, moving on. Most of the trees in my hood have sudden oak death disease. What can be done for trees with diseases like this?
Yeah, there's a lot of new diseases. Oak wilt and others. There's a new comparable disease on bur oaks. They're at this point, a lot of those diseases come in when the plant is stressed. So a lot of the stress factors are often drought. So I would say the best thing you can do in times of drought, especially with street trees, which are in real harsh urban conditions to begin with, is give them supplemental water, especially in the summertime.
All right, there we go. See, we did it. We did it. Andrew Bunting comes in. He answers all our questions on what we need to do to get ready for the winter, including how to get ready to see my hydrangea be the centerpiece of the best garden on the garden walk. I haven't decided which garden walk to join yet, but it will be center of attention. Andrew Bunting is the assistant director at the Chicago Botanic Gardens as well as the director of plant collections there. Andrew, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So there's an epigraph from 1 Corinthians 12:13. For in the one spirit, we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. It's called Conjecture on the Stained Glass Image of White Christ at Ebenezer Baptist Church. If in his image made him I, then make me a miracle. Make my shrine a copper faucet leaking everlasting Evian to the masses. Make this empty water glass a goblet of long-legged French wine. Make mine a Prince Purple body bag designed by Crown Royal for tax collectors to spill over and tide into just before I rise. If in his image made him I, then make my vessel a pearl, Coupe de Ville. Make mine the body of a 28-year-old black woman in a blue pattern maxi dress cruising through hell on earth, Texas, again alive. If in his image made her we, then why the endless string of effigies? Why so many mortal blasphemies? Why crucify me in HD across a scrolling news ticker tied to a clothesline of broken necks long as time? Is this thing on? Jesus on the ground? Jesus in the margarines of hurricane and sea, Jesus of busted levees and chocolate cities, Jesus of the Middle East, Africa, and crows flying backwards, of blood on the leaves inside diamond mines in underdeveloped mineral-rich countries. If in your image made are we, the proliferation of your tie-dyed hippie doppelganger makes you easier to daily see. And in this image, didn't we make the Godhead slightly stony, high enough to surf a cloud? And didn't we leave you there where surely paradise or justice must be meted out? Couldn't we see where water takes the form of whatever most holds it upright? If then this is what it's come down to, my faith in rifle shells and Glock 22 magazine sleeves, isn't it also then how, why, in a bucket shot full of holes I've been made to believe?
That's the poem Conjecture on the Stained Glass Image of White Christ at Ebenezer Baptist Church, the poet Marcus Wicker. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My next guest, Marcus Wicker. He just published a new collection called Silencer. In it, Wicker writes about gun violence, police brutality, and life as an African-American male growing up in the Midwest. The collection getting great reviews and high praise from critics and fellow writers alike. Wicker was just in town to read at the Chicago Poetry Foundation, and he's my guest in studio tonight. Marcus, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to meet you. This is a great collection of poems. I guess my first question is, did you set out, this is a collection over a period of time,
right?
Did you always know that there was going to be a collection called Silencer when you were writing these poems?
I did not. In fact, the book started in 2011. I just finished up edits on my first book, which had a lot to do with pop culture and masculinity, mm-hmm. these love letters to my secret heroes like Flavor Flav, RuPaul. And I was at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, so it's off the Cape. I was sort of falling in love with the natural world. I was writing these odes to the sea and the beach forest. And so, no, I didn't think that gun violence would creep into the collection. But over time, things evolve.
What I really like about the collection, too, is that I've read that you said this before, too, that when you're dealing with issues like police brutality or gun violence and their big headlines, whether it be Trayvon Martin or Eric Garner or Laquan McDonald in Chicago.
Sure.
So many people will use their words in quick takes on social media, Twitter, Facebook. It's almost where we go to get instant reaction from critics, commentators, people that we trust. We quickly see. But you choose to take time to craft the words, to write poetry. Why is this your medium? Why do you decide to do that as opposed to jump right on Twitter and talk to your followers about what you think about a certain injustice?
Sure. I mean, first thought, best thought has never been the way for me. Poetry is sort of the way that I solve for X. Sometimes there are things on my heart. I just get sort of a feeling, right? I see what's going on CNN, but I can't quite contextualize it. And so putting it on the page is a way for me to demystify my feelings for myself.
A lot of these poems are about your experience, who you are, and growing up in the Midwest around primarily white friends who never really wanted to get into the issue of race or when it gets brought up.
Right.
And also it's about, I kind of took from it too, that it's about this idea of being somebody or the contrast between who you are and who you want to be.
Right.
Where does that come from?
Well, I think a lot of the poems have to do with African Americans in academia. You know, black parents, they teach their kids all the time, education is the silver bullet. All you have to do is achieve and just be better, and then you can be who you want to be. But it turns out after you get those degrees, after you get the tenure track job, there are often roadblocks that impede your success. And so part of the project is me writing about those issues that stop success and also playing with, is this an American dream? Is this something that I actually want? Right now that I've gotten close to achieving it, is it all that it's cracked up to be? And so that's a question that I ask over and over again in the book.
Yeah, and the American dream means so many different things to so many different people. And a lot of times we seem like there's one idea, this picket fence idea of what the American dream is. And especially you and me both growing up in the Midwest, there is this ideal of making a world for yourself and making money and being able to have a family. But the American dream means something different to everybody.
So for me, initially I thought it was, you know, you get the good job where you're making a salary that you don't feel embarrassed by. You've got the mortgage, right? You've got the marriage. You've got the family. But then when you're an academic or a writer like me and you get into social circles where you're not allowed to express yourself, and that's what you've been trained to do your whole career, you realize, well, that's just as important as those other things that I used as a measuring stick.
Expression plays a big role in the collection Silencer, and really even the title. I mean, Silencer, we can't be silent. But more often than not, and even in today, even the headlines that have permeated the news in the last couple of weeks about expression, about protest, about all the issues that are happening with football and, mm-hmm. and things of that nature, you get this idea that expression is accepted in certain circles, in certain places, in the bind of a book or on a play or on a stage or maybe in a piece of music. Expression about social issues, particularly when it comes to American patriotism or other places, it is unacceptable that, right. that many people will step up and say, stop expressing yourself. Do you right. feel, is that what you're talking about, like in academia?
I do.
Like,
yeah, I think that in some ways there are issues that makes folks uncomfortable to talk about. You know, they say it's not polite to talk about God or money in polite conversations. And in academia, there's a way that if you talk about the way that black folks are disenfranchised in this country, if we talk about economic inequity, we talk about police brutality, there's a way that critics say, well, what about speaking about tetrameter, right? What about your literary heroes, right? What happened to those conversations, which are certainly important and important to the poems in the book? But right now, if I didn't use my voice to speak out against what's going on in the country, I wouldn't be doing myself justice as a poet.
Poetry has always been an acceptable form, along with other pieces of art, whether it be music or, like I said, theater, to be a vehicle for protest, to be the place where you can express yourself with the word. How powerful is the word? In Silencer, you get at a lot of the core issues that are surrounding police brutality and inequality. There's some great stuff in here when it comes to understanding yourself and race and race relations. So how important is the written word when it comes to the protest movement in 2017?
I mean, I think that there's a way that I always tell my students, once you write a poem and it's out there in the world, you're no longer there to defend it, to speak up for it. And so if you do your job well, what you put on the page goes much farther than your front door. And if it's crafted, different people will be able to interpret it and pull out different things that are important to their life. And so that's what's so powerful to me about poetry, is that it means something a little different to everyone else. But if you've done your job as a poet, the central theme or message that's going on beneath the text is always there for someone to unearth.
My guest in studio, award-winning poet Marcus Wicker, his new collection is Silencer. It's out now. And he was just in Chicago at the Chicago Poetry Foundation for a reading. A lot of the poems have to deal with police brutality. We talked about this. But what I really like about it, and this is on purpose, I've read about your story, is that they're generic stories that if you pay enough attention to the headlines, you know you're speaking about the situation in New York with Eric Garner or Trayvon Martin, even the notes on your website about these poems. But in there, you don't mention Trayvon. You don't say Eric Garner. You don't say the names of Philando Castile or other people who have become headlines and people who were affected by police brutality. Why go generic as opposed to the specific?
I think that there's a knee-jerk reaction against rhetoric, whether that be on the media or on the page. And so writing these poems in Silencer, where I write about police brutality, I write about cases that have actually occurred, but strip away some of the names and the details, it's my hope that it will be productive. Like, what's absent will stir someone. That will make them uncomfortable. So it's like, you didn't want to have this conversation with me and talk about it in public, but now that you're reading this poem on the page and it's devoid of those things that you know and that you've been avoiding in the first place, how does that feel? So in a way, it's my own silent form of protest.
It is strange to think that those victims and people who died in conflicts with police become political rhetoric. Their names. Trayvon right. Martin is a political issue.
Hashtag.
As opposed to a person. Right.
Right.
Does that surprise you?
No. I think that there's a way that we're always looking for a quick soundbite. We're always looking for what's easily digestible. And so, no, it doesn't surprise me that these people who were flesh and blood have become a punchline. No, and that's sad, but I think that's just the reality of corporate media and news in America.
You'll hear people speak up and say the issue of injustice or inequality, it's overrated. Or, and I don't mean overrated in any sort of offensive way, but that they, oh, you know, even what we see with the NFL, What are you protesting? What's actually being protested is not even being discussed because people don't want to either deal with the fact that this is an issue or they dispute that it's an issue. They outright deny that it's
because
an issue.
Because it doesn't come to their doorstep. Right?
And that's my question. When issues happen, whether it be Philando Castile or Laquan McDonald or cases that we've seen for the last 5 years over and over and over, as an African-American male yourself, what does it mean to you? Because more often than not, I hear in this chair that anyone could be Philando Castile.
That's right. And it makes me think that no matter what you achieve in this country, a bullet could always come for you. And so you've got your graduate degrees. You're a professor. It doesn't matter. Look at Henry Louis Gates Jr. He gets stopped right by Harvard at his home. Someone thinks that he's breaking into his own house. That's because of perception. That's because of stereotype. And so when people say to me, oh, we should get over these issues, we really shouldn't. Because no matter who you are as an African-American or a person of color, they always affect you.
Your case, as an African-American growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, having a lot of white friends, do you feel that you feel that injustice when it comes to the relationship with the police? Could you be, like you said, Professor Gates, or could you be a Trayvon Martin? Do you see it that way in your head? You're like, I've been in those situations. I know the injustice that's being spoken of.
I do. I mean, there was I won't mention the name of the school, a school I used to teach at in southern Indiana. And the first week that I was there, I was driving to campus. I get pulled over by a cop, and he says to me, I've seen you drive this route 4 times in the last 5 days. It's very clear to me that you're not visiting. You actually live here. Why aren't your plates changed? And so I said, sir, I just moved here, like you said, a week ago. But then it was clear to me that he'd been following me. And so then the next week when school actually starts, I get pulled over again by the same cop who scares the hell out of me with his 10-gallon hat. I'm late to my first day of class, and the provost had to call on my behalf and say, leave this guy alone. He's one of our professors. Hmm. Yeah, it can affect anyone anywhere. And it happened while I'm driving with my suit and tie on and my very regal glasses. I mean, it doesn't matter.
When we talk about protests, and it's obviously stirring up a lot, and it's funny because I've been watching the Ken Burns, the documentary, the Vietnam documentary, but in 1968, during the Civil Rights Movement, a lot of the same issues that Ken Burns chronicles and documents in this are similar to 2017, whether it be marches or sitting at lunch counters, protests over civil rights. It seems like everything that's old becomes new again. But in your sense, as a poet, as someone who's collected these essays and written these essays over the last couple of years, are we improving when it comes to race relations or at least relations between the police and African-Americans? Are we regressing? From your vantage point as a writer who with a lot of protest poems, where are we at?
I mean, I think from 1968 to the current era, certainly there's been progress. And anyone who says that there hasn't been, I think, is a little misguided. However, under the current regime, under President Trump, it seems as if white supremacists and people who sort of have that inclination have become a little bold. It's in vogue to be voicey about your predilections these days, and that scares me.
Marcus Wicker is the poet. His collection of poetry, Silencer, is out now. He was just in town at the Chicago Poetry Foundation. Marcus, thanks for coming in. Great work, and I appreciate you sitting down and talking with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, we're playing the worst. Can you believe it, Pete? Got a Tuesday night, and we got the worst, finally. 10 o'clock, 312-981-7200. This, of course, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Scott Goldstein's with us tonight, great comedian in Chicago, longtime comedian. We're going to have some fun. I'm looking forward to it. Tell us your worst. I got a good worst. I know Pete's always got a good worst. Mine's always, I feel like my worst is the same, and it's just griping about rush hour traffic. Like it's just in different ways. It's the same commute, too. It'll be the commute that goes from the West Loop to Chicago, to downtown Chicago in the morning. And I have found 18 different unique ways to call it out as the worst. This is just ridiculous.
You're basically moving in a straight line east.
There's a couple left turns, and that's where the trouble comes in.
It's going down.
All right, let's play the worst. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text, you can call in. This, of course, our segment we do every week, every Tuesday night, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. And I've got some good ones, of course. I've got the standard, the go-to that everybody desires, the Lumel Nauties gift certificate. But this week, I've also got a certificate for a desktop pre-lit, ready for this? Pre-lit, sports-themed, artificial Christmas tree.
Ooh.
Sports-themed.
What can I ask exactly, do we know what the sports theme
is
of the tree?
I wonder if you can customize it or if it's just like athlete.
Like there's like a generic basketball and a football and a glove.
It's like the blooper reel that you would get with the Sports Illustrated. And you're like, these aren't real teams. What am I watching? Is this USFL? What is this?
I'm watching a minor leaguer run into the wall.
Scott Goldstein's here. Scott, good to see you. How are you, man?
It's good to see you. This is, can I just say something? As a lifelong Chicagoan, this is Apex Chicago. We're sitting out looking at beautiful Michigan Avenue. People are waving at us. That guy. I don't know that guy, but I feel like I do.
You do.
They're just waving.
It's
this
Chicago,
is wonderful.
Right?
You're a very Chicago guy.
It's a nice place to be on a Tuesday night. Scott Goldstein, longtime comedian, improviser, director. He's directing his final show.
Final show again. It's the third time I've directed my final show.
It's at IO on Friday. We'll talk about it a little later. He's also a part of Letters to Santa, which is the 24-hour improv sketch music charity event that's at Second City every year.
Yeah, it's going to be an amazing crew this year.
November 20th and 21st.
From 5 p.m. to 5 p.m.
It's an awesome...
The room doesn't smell as good at 5 p.m. the next day, but everybody feels so happy.
You stink for charity, though.
You have to.
And you are now involved with a restaurant. You are were you part owner of Daisy's Restaurant? You call it part owner?
Yeah, a partner, investor.
Look at you. You're like a culinary... You're like
a culinary novice that happens to recognize talent in a chef.
Daisy's Restaurant up in, would that be
Logan Square.
Logan Square?
Right next to the Owl, 2523 North Milwaukee.
Nice.
Chef Joe Frillman, sometimes in life we meet these talents. You and I have met a lot of talented people. We've known each other, 20 years?
Yeah.
We have met a lot of talented people along the way. And when you recognize talent in the world, you try to enable it.
You partner up.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm no sucker. I'm like, what's a worse business than theater? And that's restaurants. But, the guy is so good that
you got to get in.
You got to get
in.
I
love it. All right. Daisy's Restaurant in Logan Square. All right. Let's play the worst. 312-981-7200. Why don't we start tonight with Pete Zimmerman like we do every single worst. Pete, what do you got tonight?
Well, first, I want to say Daisy's is awesome.
Been there.
Pastas, fabulous.
Right? If the Midwest were a region of Italy, it would be Daisy's.
Yeah.
All right.
One of my favorites of 2017 when I put my best restaurant list out.
Yeah. Where do you put that list out?
I put it on my phone.
You put it on your notes?
Yeah, my notes.
So check it out at Pete's Notes on his iPhone.
But anyway, I digress. But you know what the worst is?
What's the worst, Pete?
When videos auto-start on a website.
Yeah. No, they're getting so tricky now.
And you can't even figure out
where it's coming from. It's the worst. You know what's the worst? And every year, I feel like every day I'm making fun of the Sun-Times website. But the Sun-Times will not only throw up the online survey, which have you had a washing machine in the last 2 years? What is this? But they'll also launch another page on your tabs without you knowing. And it kind of is one of those sneaky ones that's behind. So then that starts playing, and you're like, none of my tabs, I don't know where this is coming from. And you realize that it's the sneaky page behind, and the Sun-Times doing that stuff. That's like so 2004.
There's a way around that Sun-Times survey. Just choose not to answer.
I know.
There's literally
a
box that says choose not to answer. I refuse to give them any information.
I like to give them fake information, like I'm playing along, and then they've caught up to me where now they're like getting me to write things. Like I think it was yesterday, they're like, do you ever take an online course? And I'm like, yes. They're like, if so, write in what it is. I'm like, oh, now I got to get the keyboard out? I was like, I thought I was just mousing this thing. So. All right, so that is the worst. The videos that play and it's sports is so it's sports sites are the worst.
Fantasy football sites.
God.
All of a sudden you're listening to Matthew Berry talk and you know what? I don't want to hear him talk. There's a reason that he's not on television.
Sit him or quit him.
That was actually the impetus for this worse, because that's exactly what happened today. I'm hearing Matthew Berry for some reason.
Nobody wants to hear Matthew Berry.
It's amazing. It's the sports ones, and it's usually some sort of – it's Matthew Berry or it's like a panel.
Eric Carabel.
Eric Carabel. Here we are, Eric Carabel and all the writers here at CBS Sports. What do we think of Masahiro Tanaka? You're like, how do you shut this off? All right, Scott, what do you think? What do you got for the worst?
For the worst, I mean, everything is the worst. That's kind of, I mean, I live my life that way. I think everything is the worst, and I also think everything is the best. I try to be an optimist. Today, the worst was, at first, I couldn't find parking. And then when I was driving, a woman pulled out in a GMC Terrain right out of the parking garage while traffic was moving and slid right in. Like, you know, just no stop.
Right.
And I hammered the horn.
Give him a long horn or a tap?
I gave a long horn.
Yeah.
And she insta-fingered me. And I'm driving behind her on Sheffield. And she takes a left on Clybourne, a left where she doesn't use the turn signal. And she just goes left. And it's definitely a red light at this point. And I keep driving up Sheffield. Next thing I know, I'm passing Wrightwood and Sheffield over by, I'll just say it, by the Malnati's.
Yeah,
it's
right.
A pretty good one over there.
Yeah, right.
And I'm driving, and all of a sudden, she's behind me. She looped back, and now I'm thinking,
she got like a road rage thing going on.
Well, the world is full of lunatics, and we all know this. And people apparently are on edge, and I try to be really nice to people. I talked to, you know, you came out, I'm talking to the dorm room.
Right,
by the way, T at the Tribune Tower desk is one of the greatest Chicagoans. Great human being.
There you go. You're making friends every day, Scott.
But I finally, I veered off my route at Newport, and I turned left. She kept going. I said, what was this all about? And the worst is the fear that at any moment, any citizen of this world will snap and go nuts on you.
I have something similar where the worst I have is traffic related as well. And it has to do that in really very specific terms. I have to turn left from Monroe Street and down Lower Wacker, like to get onto the ramp at Monroe. And to do that, you wait in a single file line of about 9 or 10 cars to make that turn. Three go through it every time. You know, there's a lot, it's a ballet because you have a throng.
Rule of threes.
Think about how many pedestrians at that time at 8:15, 8:30 in the morning are crossing Wacker. You know, I mean, it's just like the guy who like runs a little towards the end. You're like, what are you doing? You can't. You ruin it. You're ruining a ballet by running here. So you got all that. And so you get up to your time, and you got your nose in there, and you're just kind of waiting, and you're like, and inevitably, and it happens every day, a cab driver, and I will equal opportunity hater on the rideshare guys too, but a cab driver will bypass the 10 cars, the 9 cars are lined up, and come in from the straight lane to turn in front of you, with not a wave, without a nod, without an apology, just knowing full well that he is screwing over probably 45 people in this scenario, and he's doing it, and he does not care. That's and what I find myself is I get raged out. That's where I'm like, I start half sentences. My wife's like, what do you care? And I'm like, I get Walter Sobchak again. Am I the only one who cares about the rules? Am I the only one who cares about the
Shomer
rules?
Shabbos.
Shomer Shabbos.
But more importantly, let's just put it into perspective. Both of our problems. First of all,
dumb.
I remind myself, person cuts me off, person gives me the finger, fine. I'm driving a car, which is great. Like, I'm in a vehicle that's functioning. There's a lot of places in the world where people don't have that.
Right, right.
And as far as that cab driver, who knows? That cab driver probably spent $350,000 on a medallion that is now worth, what, 75 grand?
Right, right.
So he says, I'm going to make this turn.
Okay, here we go. We're going to go to a break here, but 630 says, you know what's the worst? Justin complaining about his commute for the 19th time. And then 847 says, you know what's the worst? Long, involved traffic stories. We all have them, but no one wants to hear them.
You know what the worst is? 630 and 847. Back in my day, it was 312 and 708, and that was it.
That's it. 312-981-7200. We got lots of texts and calls coming in. We're playing the worst tonight. For prizes, Scott Goldstein's in studio. Stay with us. Playing the worst today, 312-981-7200. Scott Goldstein in studio. We're giving away prizes. We complain about the worst things in society. 312, the worst double parking on Ashland. Yeah.
double parking on it. They, you know, they wanted to turn Ashland into that BRT
the
plan.
Yeah, the bus thing. Yeah.
They were like, don't worry, the average speed will drop to 9.8 miles per hour.
And people will still double park and block the whole street. 773 says, the worst is when you wake up, get dressed, and go to class, but it's Saturday. Yeah, that sounds like right out of like a movie plot.
I don't know if that's the worst. I would be happy to show up and be like, oh, there is no class.
Yeah.
So there's a silver lining.
There is, right. All right. Let's see here. 847, you know what's the worst? Rashes. Anywhere.
You can't argue that.
That's a front runner tonight.
I don't think there's anybody who's ever hoped for a rash.
There's no... 312 says the worst long Facebook posts. Yeah, Pete had it. What was the line that you had a couple weeks ago on the long Facebook post? It was like, it starts off, anyone that starts off, and they're like, you know, if you don't want to hear read this, .. like whatever before the long post. Like
that's
the,
how you hook me.
Yeah, you hook
up. I'll read the whole thing then.
I'll read it. You know, if you know, this is going to get, anytime you see more, I guess that's the thing, right? Then you know you're in trouble.
It depends. The first one I'll read, and then if it's a series of them.
Yeah.
But I'm going to be fascinated with your life and whatever's going on in your mind.
Right.
If I am into bad Facebook posts.
How long is the longest Facebook post you've ever written? I mean, are you talking, have you ever done a treatise? Or you've done like one that you're like, this is my problem with the Cubs, and you've done like 16 paragraphs?
I've done some. I try to go for brevity, and I try to keep it reasonable because I understand, you know, it's social media supposed to be quick, easy, happy. Longest one ever probably was related to sports.
Yeah,
the catharsis of championships.
Have you had a post with a Seymour?
Sure.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever.
Not a lot.
Yeah,
I hope. I don't want to be one of those.
You
got to
go back tonight and check it out. Make sure you're not a Seymour guy.
I check on this day feature allows me to go back and realize how poorly I handled social media in like 2009.
I love when every time I wake up and I open up Facebook, they're like, hey, we just want to remind you of this friendship. I'm like, I don't know.
We don't even talk anymore.
I don't talk to this person. 708 says the worst was on Sunday. I was prepping for a colonoscopy.
Woof.
Can't eat anything for Monday morning. My wife and I decided to go to Costco to stock up on food and non-food essentials. Since I was starving, that was hard enough, but I had forgotten all about the free food samples. What a crappy day.
No pun intended.
No pun intended.
You know, at least you feel good when you get everything out of your system before a colonoscopy, right?
I may be in the minority, but when I go to Costco, rarely am I wowed by the free food samples.
I'm usually like, wow, this looks great, and then I eat it, and I'm like, it tastes like breaded rubber. But have you had a colonoscopy?
I have not, no.
I haven't, and I'm 40, I'm going to be 44 in January.
It's about time, yeah.
And I'm lucky. I have a friend from high school who's the head of gastroenterology at a hospital in Seattle. Although he tells everybody he's a cardiothoracic surgeon. And I turned him, we were at Round of Japan once, and he said that because you sit with other people at Round of Japan, and he goes, I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon. I look at him. After dinner, he says, if you tell anybody you're a gastroenterologist, all they want to do is talk to you about their stomach pain.
That's so true.
But he's going to do my colonoscopy, so I'm excited. When it's time, I'm going out.
Is that weird that the guy knows you and he's going to be doing a colonoscopy?
I feel more comfortable
with
a guy. I mean, first of all, very smart.
Yeah, I'm not questioning your friend's intelligence. I'm just saying I would think that I would want a professional stranger to do that procedure, not a buddy that
I want Dr. Andy Ross to do my – he's the only one who's allowed to touch my colon.
There you go. 312 says the worst, open-face sandwiches. I'm in that. Yeah, there's a restaurant in Chicago that does the open-faced Reuben. And it drives me crazy because I'm like, this is no, you squeeze part of that is to squeeze the bread together.
All about hands.
Yeah. It's all about
hands. What about
the
patty melt? What's your stand on the patty melt?
I'll eat a good patty melt, but I don't like it open faced.
Okay.
I would definitely, I mean, you want a patty melt, it's like squeeze it down.
But then why not just make it a burger?
Well, it's because it's a rye bread, right? It's a rye or like a, it's the patty's more like a sandwich. I'm just saying.
Rye bread's not meant to hold a burger.
It's a specialty item. It's not something I'm eating every day.
Like I think it's a melt. 50s item. Like patty melts, French dips.
Yeah. Monte Cristo.
Yeah, Monte Cristo. Oof. Which is just basically fried chicken.
Fried ham?
No, there's chicken.
Is there chicken?
Ham. Gee, I'm a restaurateur now. I got to stay on top of this game. We got a ham provolone.
Yeah, I think it's like a, it just feels like a white cheese. There's a white cheese involved. I don't know which one.
Not one of the good ones.
Like a Gruyere?
A Gruyere is a nice
doubt
cheese.
It, but it's a nice cheese, but yeah. I doubt that's in there. The worst is, okay, hold on. The worst is that, no, let's skip that one. The worst is no cars in the drive-thru up ahead, only for it to fill up right before you commit to going through it. Yeah.
Well, in my
that's
youth.
That's every situation for me.
The drive, every, like.
In general, I remember this weekend I had an issue where I forgot what it was, but the sentiment is exact, where we pulled up and I saw there was no waiting at the thing, and I tried to rush my family out of the car.
Oh, no.
And that was the kind of thing where I was going to go park, and I was like, go, get. Like,
you told them, get out of the car,
get in line. They're like, what? As they're getting their jacket and their hat. I'm like, get out of the car.
You'll bring everything to them.
And then someone, like, I think I was waiting for breakfast, you know, then three people, like, meandered up and got in front of him, and I was like, I was sour for like 15 minutes for that.
Why are we all waiting for breakfast? I mean, you go to Walker Brothers, you go to all these places, and you have to wait for breakfast.
Yeah,
there's a line for breakfast everywhere.
Everywhere. Is there a place in that there isn't a line?
The McDonald's drive-through right before you pull up.
Right. 773 says the worst is when a cab gives you the "get in my vehicle" prostitution honk when you're in front of your apartment. I don't know what that is, but I think I get the concept. Like, you need a ride?
You need a ride? Come on. You need a ride? You need a little. That gesture you're doing with your hand, the crowd can't see, but it does look like a prostitution move.
Yeah, right. It's good. It's very handsy. all right, let's keep going here. The worst. Oh, 920. Let's see that. You get one colonoscopy, you get them all. The worst is doing all the prep work for a colonoscopy and the doctor cancels the procedure. Yeah, that ain't right. That ain't love. You got to be drinking that stuff and doing the whole prep, and then they're like, you know what? Doctor's got vacay.
You know, I drank that stuff for fun once. It's not like for fun, but
like a party trick.
Well, my wife and I were talking about, you know, she was saying, what is it when you get your colon irrigated? Why is the word not coming to my head?
I don't know.
You get it's not an enema. It's the deeper one. It's a colonic.
Yeah.
And
okay.
my friend, the gastroenterologist, said, terrible for you. Tell you what, just drink this stuff and you'll get the same experience. We couldn't leave the house for 2 days.
Oh, what are you doing?
This was years ago.
That sounds like
we were trying to be healthy.
It's, you know what it sounds like? It sounds like an improviser. It sounds like you're an improviser, just like me. You'd be like, you know, this would be a great bit.
You know what? Yeah,
great bit.
Oh, I've done horrible things for bits.
I know, right?
But it's always fun, except when you can't leave the house.
847 says the worst: running into your wife when you're on a date. Okay, all right, we get it.
Who needs that complex of a life?
All right, we're having some fun tonight. The worst, some good stuff. Open face sandwiches and rashes in the lead.
Neither one of those things are on my top 10 list.
Yeah, there you go. Those, I think that's the lead right now. Those are the ones to beat. Can you beat it? 312-981-7200. Scott Goldstein with us. We will continue the second half of the worst right after Rob's news. Stay with us.
It's going down,
It's the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Playing the worst. Scott Goldstein is here. A lot of things to plug. The restaurateur, the improviser, the impresario.
I don't know. The weird thing is plugging anything at all, because all I am is a guy from Chicago who just does stuff.
Yeah. Well, you do this. You got Daisy's Restaurant, 2523 North Milwaukee and Logan Square. You're directing your last show again. At IO. What's the name of the show?
Tom Fell is Tom Fell in Tom Fell, the greatest comedian of his generation, looks back on his career, a retrospective.
That's Friday night. Opens Friday night?
Opens Friday night.
That's awesome.
8:30.
Letters of Santa, which is coming up, to 24-hour improv show that great comedians.
Wonderful woman, Heather Winna, who's like the director of alumni relations at Second City. She puts that together every year. Blood, sweat, and tears. 100% of the funds go out to help people in the community.
No, that's November 20th through the 21st.
Correct.
We also have TrueChicago.co.
True Chicago, which is this weekend. Corey Gilkey of Leaders, I believe, is sponsoring it. And David Johnson, who's a very talented photographer. It's his brainchild. And it's an idea to get people who are creative entrepreneurs together and to help people who are trying to find their footing in the creative world.
You got too much going on.
Well, I'll sleep on the 12th. The 12th is just the Packers, Bears, and then the Hawks, right. Devils.
Oh, that's a good combo. Yeah.
I love this
city.
Did
you see that the Bears are favored for the first time in 9 years?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
And it's also completely scary because the Bears are going to screw it up.
Somehow this will go wrong, and Hundley will throw for 400 yards.
They figured
yards
out the right
touchdowns.
Ship, right? My prediction is Aaron Rodgers will be back for Sunday.
Somehow.
Yeah.
But I love Trubisky. I mean, I have to admit, just the feeling of him being in a game is completely different. I don't remember. My favorite Bears quarterback of all time is Sid Luckman. And probably because he belonged to my family synagogue and used to hit on my sister when she worked at the Tremont Hotel. But, you know, I mean, like, what else do you have? I mean, Bobby Douglas was before my time. Right. My dad would say,
boy,
Bobby could run. But yeah,
my dad loves Bobby Douglas.
Bobby could run. Bobby couldn't throw, but Bobby could run. And then my childhood was like Bob Avellini.
Yeah, Vince Evans.
Vince Evans, might as well have been playing for the other team. we had those wonderful moments with the punky QB, Jim McMahon.
Right, right.
That was
punctuated with a Steve Fuller and a Doug Flutie and a Mike Tomczak and
don't
a P.T.
forget
Willis.
P.T. Willis. Yeah, P.T. thank Willis. You. We've had some great quarterbacks here. Moses Moreno, Rick Meyer.
Rick Meyer, right. Dave Craig.
Dave Craig
was here.
He was great for the Seahawks and the exact opposite with the Bears.
You go on.
There's a lot of quarterbacks. Trubisky is officially now my second favorite Bears quarterback of all time.
We'll check in with that in about 2 years, see where we're at with that.
The bar is so low.
It's so low. 312-981-7200. We're playing the worst. All right. The worst, getting a defective straw with your to-go drink. Yeah.
I mean.
It is. I mean, it's defective straws.
We shouldn't use straws. I saw one of those videos with a turtle where they pulled a straw out of its nose, and I can't stop thinking about it. That was like a year ago.
It's the worst plastic. Like, there was, the straws. There's some of the restaurants in Chicago are getting rid of straws.
Yeah, I don't think we have them.
Yeah.
Maybe we do.
You probably do.
We do have them.
Because there the fear of a dirty glass or the idea that this glass has been used by 6,000 people trumps the fear of ruining the oceans.
Have you seen, you see those videos with the plastic floating? Yeah. Look at it. I'm drinking out of cardboard.
You think?
I think. I don't know what this is.
630, this is this is one I would put in the top three. Ready? 630 says, the worst is the L-train drivers that creep into a station, start, stop, start, stop, start, stop, start,
are they
stop.
Sure this is, wait, an L-train driver?
There's one driver,
well,
right?
Well, it's a conductor, right? Engineer. Yeah.
I like L-train driver.
I like
What do you do for a living? I'm an L-train driver.
I drive the L, I drive the orange line.
I
drive it slow and creepy, right the midway.
Start, stop, start, stop. The worst is going to the bathroom.
I mean, yeah.
Hold on, where'd that go?
Oh, there's more to that.
There's
one?
More to that one. I lost it.
Going to the bathroom is actually great for reading.
Yeah.
Interacting with social
media. We'll come back to that one. It's essentially about when guys go to the bathroom in public bathrooms and they keep the seat down.
You know,
it is gross.
It's gross because you never know when you're going to have an emergency. Yeah. I had an emergency once after eating a Nashville hot chicken at the United Center, and I had to use the bathroom there, and it was like this
same thing.
It was a terrible moment.
Well, in those situations, especially at a public restroom, it's when guys learn to operate toilets with their feet.
Oh, my shoes are just soiled.
Yeah,
I take
so
my shoes off.
So there's something to be said about it. You know, the idea that the act of reaching down and lifting that toilet seat up is a pretty gross act in some restrooms.
Kick it up with your feet.
You gotta be good at it. The worst is when your gas gauge is broken, so you rely on the gallon used function to know how much gas you have. Your son borrows your car and resets it, so you don't know you didn't put gas, and you run out of gas on your way to work. That's so specific. 219. That says.
I mean,
sucks.
That
sucks. Yeah, I don't know.
You
to
ground
say.
The kid for that one?
I don't know.
Or ground the kid, or you have him go to the learn how to fix a gas gauge.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably on him, 219, or her, because why is the gas gauge broke?
Well, you punish the kid for resetting the miles driven.
Why is he resetting the miles driven? He's just messing around with it?
He's probably not supposed to drive the car. This is like a Ferris Bueller situation.
He's rolling back
the Bueller-ing it.
Speedometer. 630 says the worst is being behind the car with the $50 order in the pay it forward line at Starbucks when you only ordered a coffee. Is that a thing, to pay it forward?
So wait, you have to pay for the car ahead of you?
How is that even possible?
Or they pay for you. Oh, they're saying because they paid, like, you would have gotten more if you had known somebody was paying for you.
Yeah, I think, or...
This is what they say in Yiddish. This is a schnorrer. They're not happy with what they get. You know, they're like, if I'd known it was going to be free, I would have gotten more.
949 says, the worst is when your Tinder match rejects you by telling you that you're as annoying as the soda tax. You know what? I just want to make something clear, 949. If the person is saying, you're as annoying as the soda tax, it wasn't going to work out.
Yeah.
That's a dumb thing to say.
I think this is somebody, this is an anti-soda tax person that's just sliding this in here.
Sliding it in.
I really wasn't that offended. The soda tax didn't affect me. I drink a lot of LaCroix.
Yeah, right.
But I gave up.
Yeah,
soda.
Don't get me started. I was pro soda tax. I was the only person I think in Chicago that was.
I was.
You were apathetic to it.
I was not apathetic. At the fear of earning hate mail, which is why I won't give my address. I was pro soda tax.
Yeah, me too.
But I guess it affected a lot of people who felt differently. So I apologize for being pro soda tax.
The good news is we let our politicians work that out, and they did.
Yes, they worked it out.
They worked it out.
The lobbyists and
they all worked it out. Let's see. The worst is when you're out. 708 says the worst is when you're out with your kids for pizza, and the table behind you are three drunk guys talking about the chicks they you know. Yikes. That's
specific too.
Specific, yeah.
At Lou Malnati's, you're always guaranteed a good time. Good, clean family fun.
It's a good one. All right. The worst is running a 5K, the 630, trying to dodge horse manure while it's absolutely pouring. Ugh, that's a trifecta.
That's pretty bad. That's one of the reasons I ran one 5K. It was the Bears 5K. My friend Greg Worsley, who's about, he's maybe in worse shape than I am. We ran it, and I started out, and within the first K, I was like, why is everybody so slow? And I sprinted around a bunch of people, and I sprained my ankle. The last 4K were terrible. I finally saw Tom Thayer, and they had like a tackling dummy set up, and I was like, I have to finish this thing, because I'm never running another 5K again. This isn't for me. And right. I said, out of my way, Thayer, and I went blitzing through the tackling dummies, and I think I finished the 5K in about 45 minutes. Which turns out not a good time.
Not a good time. 312 says getting an email from school saying someone has lice. Check your child. That is the worst. I've been there.
You've had that happen?
Uh-huh.
Did your child have lice?
Yes. When he was 2 years, 3 years old, 4 years old, something like that.
Is it a positive for you that you don't have hair on top now?
It does.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, I remember this. So when I had to, you go to one of these like lice places in Lincoln Park. There was like a place that you go. It's like, lice it off, you know?
There's a specific business in Lincoln Park.
There's a couple of them in Chicago that will do it. It's expensive. It's like $200. And you go, and they will painstakingly go through your child's hair and remove it.
By hand?
Pretty much by hand. Like, they guess they're able to do it. And so when I was, they had to check my wife, and she came clear, but she's got long hair. And they're like, and I was next. I'm like, I hope. And they're like, you're good. And I was like, yeah, I know, I get it, but I'm like, what about my beard? And I'm like, yeah, and they're like, no, they don't go in the beard. You're good. So I was like, I feel kind of left out.
Well, at least you saved a couple $100.
Yeah, that's true. So there you go.
That's a great margin on a business.
It is, it's bad. I mean, it's something that rarely gets talked about, but I'm telling you, man, it's CPS and any school, really, and parents will know it, daycares. The minute it gets one kid, it's in all kids, and you essentially there's nothing you can do. You're like, oh, we got to go get checked? Oh.
And someone without children, the closest I've ever come to that is like a dog park situation where every dog ends up with Giardia. Which I bet it's a lot nicer to have a child with lice than a dog with Giardia.
Probably. All right, keep it going here. 312-981-7200. When the CTA female bus driver shuts the door after I put my one foot on the first step, and she takes off after seeing me, and then they give a date and a time. I'm like, nah,
okay, so this is a very specific gripe.
Not that relatable, but I have found, Scott, that in my life, the biggest sort of rage moments, it was cabs. Before that, when I was taking the train and the bus, when the CTA lets you down, there's nothing. It's like the biggest wrong Clark, in your entire life.
Clark and North the other day, 72 bus went right past me in the rain.
I get superhuman strength. What I do if a bus blows me off, I'll run. I'll run to try and get to the next block so I can show up and be like, you tried.
I learned my lesson about running after that 5K. I just let loose a string of like terrible words that I can't say on the radio.
Right. A Monte Cristo is ham and Swiss on French toast.
But is there no chicken on a Monte Cristo?
It says ham and I can't fact check this, but 708 seems to be very definitive.
I'm sorry. I apologize, 708. I was thinking of a chicken cordon bleu.
Yeah, that's got the name chicken in it. So you can
and
see
it's named after the finest cooking school.
That's right. All right. Let's see here. 312, did I say this one? Halloween vultures who swoop in and suck up all the discounted candy the day after Halloween at the Walgreens before sunup. That's when you're supposed to do it, right?
When else? Vampires can't come up after the sun comes up. They've got to get there while it's dark.
I will say, on Halloween Day, I was rolling through the Target, and I went over by the Halloween stuff because I'm like, you know, I'm going to just get some fangs.
Stock up for next year.
Yeah, see what's there. And it was all gone. They were already putting the Christmas stuff up. Like that, they chose the day of Halloween to get ready for the next thing, which was Christmas. And I could have swore, we reported on the station too, that Target was pulling back on what they called the Christmas creep. Like the idea that they do it so early.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the memo got down to the local Target.
Did they actually pull it on October 31st?
Yeah, and October 31st was stockings and stuff like that.
You should get a couple weeks of just like cornucopia things. And,
right.
Thanksgiving
some
items.
Some fall, some woody stuff.
Yeah.
Right. All right, 312-981-7200. Scott Goldstein in studio. What we'll do, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get to the ones that we have remaining, and we will crown our victors for this week's The Worst. Stay with us.
What's going down, y'all?
Playing The Worst here, 312-981-7200. Scott Goldstein in studio. All right, let's get to some of these here. You should call people with long post Seymours. That's good.
That's not bad. That's pretty good.
I
should get out of here. That person should come in.
630 says the worst is having 5 teeth pulled at once and only getting Novocaine. Oof.
Yeah, that's bad.
Five at once. What's going on?
That's that. That's a lot of soda.
Yeah.
That's why the tax.
Tax would have worked. Yeah.
I lost. You know, I've cracked 4 teeth this year.
Cracked them?
I had to start. So I was stupid when I was young and I did things that, you know, were bad for your teeth. And I have a number of fake teeth, especially in the back. And apparently sometime around about a year ago, I started grinding my teeth for some reason. maybe it was a constant refreshing of the news. But I now have to wear a mouth guard to sleep.
Oh, man. And it's the worst.
It's pretty bad.
When you have to start wearing stuff to sleep, like corrective stuff, that's the worst.
Yeah. Like, I never wore headgear.
Yeah, I had a headgear when I was in... I think I did. I can barely remember it.
But this was, yeah.
I also remember in grade school, probably like 7th or 8th grade, probably 3 different times having to go through the trash to find my retainer.
That's a... Yeah, I've seen that happen a lot.
Like in adult life?
I know. I watched my friend Aaron Shapiro threw his retainer away at like the Burger King on Irving Park in Clark when we were going to Graceland Cemetery on a field trip in 8th grade. And, yes. He threw it away. He had to go through. I mean, that's,
he had to go through the Burger King trash.
I mean, that's a serious item.
I know. That's you can't go home without it.
No.
773 says supervisors who respond with no worries, which translated means I couldn't care less. I'm doing it anyway.
I like no worries.
I'm a big fan of no worries.
My wife used to say no worries when we met, and I used to go, I don't like this, and now I say it all the time. And now she says, you're welcome.
773 says the worst is a radio station playing only Christmas music a week after Halloween. This turkey says, back off, Santa. That's what they said?
Or?
Yeah, that's what they say. That's good.
Yeah, Thanksgiving deserves its own breath.
It doesn't get the respect. Like, no. It just gets skipped over. It's not enough. It's not commercialized enough. The only respect you get is when they do the 2-hour Beyonce special.
Yeah, and the dog show.
Right, and the dog show, right. Some football, which still at the same time.
Usually it involves the Lions and the Cowboys, so.
Ugh. I lost a bet early in my life because I never put 2 and 2 together that it was always the Lions and the Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
And someone was like, yeah, they always play. I'm like, no, they don't. It's a lot of different teams. It's the Cowboys, and then it's the Lions, and then it's
two other teams that are playing the Lions or the Cowboys.
Like, I think I put money on it. I was like insistent, and I lost that bet. 847 says the worst is when three people in out of 10 insist on a meeting, and then they don't say a word during the meeting.
I think the people that don't talk during the meeting are the smartest people in the meeting.
It gets it over with, right?
But
all right, we'll keep going here. 312 says the worst is when you need to thread a belt in a hurry. Oh, the loops are too small. I missed the loop. And then they go, and then there's just two hanging Chad words, lint, detours. So I think they just add other things that are the worst.
I mean, lint and detours are pretty bad.
That's pretty good.
Move them up in the ratings.
773 says, I have a problem with this too. When Uber stops in the middle of the street to pick somebody up who's nowhere in sight, and then there's a giant open curb space like 15 feet up, they decide to stop right in the road.
They need to simplify just a basic training.
Yeah.
All the rideshare drivers, just please learn to pull over to the curb.
It's amazing to me. Cabs do it too. And I guess I've complained about this before. Their business is about making their customer happy. And it's why, if you think about the business of our transportation, there's a thing that it's almost socialism in the way that we all want it to work together so we can get to where we need to go together or fastest. And cabs and ride shares, they get in the way of that socialism with their capitalism because they're like, I need to make money off of this right now, so I don't care about that you're behind me. They ruin that's kind of how I break it down. Right?
Okay. as I look at a bus pull up outside the stadium.
Yeah, the bay of the bus.
There's no free transportation.
No, it's not free. I'm just saying, like, the idea that we all work together on a project.
Synergistically.
We all work together to best get to our spot, wherever we have to go. And the livery service, in this case, cabs and rideshare, they don't care. They're interested in making sure that you're okay because you're going to tip them and give them money, so they will stop us from getting where
we need
to go.
They will prevent the rest of society from getting where they need to go.
Right.
Is that irony?
It seems it's something-y.
Okay.
Let's put that. 708 says it's the worst is that Apple doesn't call its battery charger Apple Juice. That's pretty good. It's a good bit. 262, I was exposed to lice at work. My boss provided me with lice-killing shampoo. I ran the building out of hot water and used the entire bottle everywhere in my body.
I don't know if that's everywhere on your body. That's called crabs.
I don't think that's technically
like my body.
I think they're just trying to get it all done.
I think there might be a case there.
708, the worst is having your birthday fall on Thanksgiving and you have to cook. Oh, yeah, that would be a tough birthday.
That's pretty bad. I think the Christmas birthday is worse, though.
Yeah. But you never hear too much complaints out of the Thanksgiving birthday.
No, because it's not going to always be the same.
Yeah, because
it's going to be sporadic.
Once every, yeah.
But the Christmas birthday is forever.
Yeah.
New Year's Day.
Yeah.
Halloween's a bad birthday.
Because then it's just always...
Everybody's stealing your thunder.
Well, my sister-in-law, Robin, her birthday's on Halloween. And the issue is, that you have to get like a Halloween-y kind of card. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just get a birthday card. It's got to be Halloween-y.
No one ever asked her to be a costume party.
Yeah. No one asked her if she's okay with that. Like,
does she dress up?
Yeah, she does.
Okay.
Yeah, she's really good at it. 773.
It's her day.
Yeah. The worst is running out of candy when their trick-or-treater's still out. I had to turn my lights off in the house. I felt terrible every time the bell rang.
When you forget that it's that day that isn't Halloween and you haven't bought the candy yet, it's turn off the lights, hide behind the curtains.
Yep. It really is. All right. We ready? Scott Goldstein's here. Scott's got a litany of things that he's got going on in his life. He's got his directing the show at I.O., which opens this Friday. Name of the show again?
Tom Fell is Tom Fell. In Tom Fell, the greatest comedian of his generation looks back on his career, a retrospective.
Also doing Letter to Santa, the 24-hour improv for charity on November 20th through the 21st. He's also truechicago.co. Check that out. And he also is the partner restaurateur for Daisy's Restaurant up in Logan Square. Lots going on there. All right, so here's what we got. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right, so here are what we're giving away tonight. I got to find what I did with that list. I got it. Don't panic. It's just in all these lists. Okay, here we go. So third place tonight is going to get you a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Second place is going to get you a certificate for a desktop pre-lit sports-themed artificial tree. Come by to Tree Time on Pepper Road in Lake Barrington to pick out this team theme of your choice while supplies last. We'll give away two of those and a pizza. A Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. All right, so Lou Malnati's.
The best.
You ready? Lou Malnati's, the worst, rashes.
I mean,
any rash.
100%.
100%.
You can't, there's not never been a good rash other than gym rash.
Second place was going to get you a certificate for a desktop pre-lit sports team artificial tree, 312, with open face sandwiches.
Universally loathed.
And first place tonight, also getting the tree, has to be the L driver. Who starts, stop, starts, stop, starts, stop, starts, stop. Only because you called it an L driver instead of a conductor.
Isn't L driver Daryl Hannah's character in the Kill Bill movies? I'm pretty sure it is.
Scott Goldstein, great to see you, buddy.
Great to see
Thanks
you,
for
Justin.
Playing the worst.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.